forget me. Look at me, teacher. Look.
You think I'm crazy? Huh? Is that what he told you? Well, listen up! There is a storm coming! Like nothing you have ever seen! And not a one of you is prepared for it!
Sleep well in your beds. Because if this thing comes true, there ain't gonna be any more.
It's an elevator. Somebody sent those dead up here to get us. Now, there's no controls inside, but there's maintenance overrides in there. I think I can get it to go down.
Do we want to go down?
Where else are we going to go?
Well, it's too bad that you couldn't help your little friend. That little girl. What was her name again? Rue? Yeah, well, we killed her. And now, we're gonna kill you.
You don't understand. You don't know. This place isn't what we thought it was. They aren't what we thought they were. I was wrong. We were so wrong. We must leave.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you?
I am well.
And in the state of New York?
Are you talking to me?
Oh, very good.
Yeah, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
All right, how you doing?
Good, good. And Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good.
And in the state of Massachusetts?
This is Abe here.
Abe, how's it going?
I'm all right.
I tricked you guys. I flip-flopped Chrissy and Abe tonight for some reason.
I know. I was shocked. I'm like, why am I going first?
Well, the house cleaning part, I like switching them, and I forgot that this wasn't the house cleaning part, and people understand that in a second because Abe gives off a spiel about the Dark Discussion webpage when we get to that. But anyway, speaking of house cleaning, Eric, you do another podcast. Actually, you do three other podcasts.
I do. One of them I record and produce myself. It's a general interest podcast called the Ascansity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on Stitcher and any iTunes store. The other two podcasts I do are directly related to this one. They're spinoffs, hosted by myself, Mike, and Phil. One comes on while Game of Thrones is on the air, and we go episode by episode through that television show on You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast. And currently, we're doing Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast, going week by week through the episodes of the HBO series Westworld.
Excellent. Very good. And Mike, you do a genre blog. I mean, you also do those two podcasts, as Eric mentioned, but you also do a genre blog.
On occasion, that's a website called Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com.
Very good. And Chrissy, you do things?
I do lots of things.
I've heard.
Quite questionable. You can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com. I write short fiction. I do a YouTube series. I do a bunch of stuff. Check it out.
Very good. And Chrissy, you actually have a new story coming out in a new anthology that should be out in October.
I do. My short story Roots is coming out in Pernicious. Right? Is that
Pernicious Invaders. That's right.
Yes. From Great Old Ones Publishing, and it will be out at the end of October.
Excellent. Very good. Yep. So that'll be exciting. We'll give further details when we get closer to that. Also, Abe, you do a genre blog.
Yep, it's called The Reeler Movie Reviewer. If you want to find it, you can go to the search engine and type in R-E-E-L-E-R Movie Reviewer. Or an easier way to find it is go to Dr. Carson's main page and look on your right-hand side. There'll be a link to my blog there, along with everything else that's mentioned passing. And we've got a few other friends you might want to pay a visit to as well.
Yep, that's right. And that's www.darkdiscussions.com. At the bottom of every page are links to the Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast, the email, darkdiscussions@aol.one, Twitter, darkdiscussion1, the RSS feed, Stitcher, and iTunes. And you can listen to all the episodes of darkdiscussions.com. All the episodes of Dark Discussions Podcast, plus the You Know Nothing Jon Snow Podcast and Westworld Podcast, Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, right off darkdiscussions.com if you prefer. And also, we're on, as I said, Stitcher and iTunes. And we discuss intelligently a genre that deserves intelligence, which is horror, sci-fi, thrillers, techno-thrillers, mysteries, fantasies, exploitation, grindhouse, drive-ins, and anything that is cult. So, a couple of things. First thing is we have a donate button for the podcast. Folks who are interested, it's called www.patreon.com/darkdiscussions. Reason we put it up was a couple of our listeners were asking to donate to the podcast, and so we finally put it up. What you can do is you go there, donate to the podcast. If you do donate, for every $5 each month, you can pick a film for us to review. So every quarter we'll pick randomly out of the figurative hat all the people who have donated. So if you donate $15 one month, you can choose three different films or the same film three times if you prefer, and they will be thrown into the figurative hat. The first pulling was last week. Abe, you were not on the episode, but the film that was pulled was The Howling. So we're going to do that probably around Halloween, I think. Maybe make it the Halloween film. But that's right. Very good.
That was this especially sexy.
It was.
Thank
it
you,
was.
Abe.
There's a calendar. Mike, we have a deadline for October 31st.
Yes, we do.
Let me let folks know about this.
Okay. For 2017, we are putting out a Dark Discussions calendar that will be packed with all sorts of informative information, like, the birthday of Bruce Campbell, or, maybe the release date of the original Frankenstein. Any number of different bits of information will be in there, as provided largely by Dark Discussions listener Chris Genro. And we are still soliciting artwork for the 12 months. Many of the months are already claimed. But if you have any artwork that you'd be interested in providing or donating, you can contact Phil at darkdiscussions@aol.com, and yep, he'll let you know what months are available.
Excellent. Very good. We do have a couple of emails. We'll read those at the end of the episode. I think one from a new person, too, someone that we know, but they've never written to the podcast before. I'll have to look at it while we discuss the film. But okay, so we got a new Terror Tantrum. Patrick Lacey is back. Let's hear what Mr. Lacey has to say.
And welcome to another edition of Terror Tantrums. My name is Patrick Lacey. I'm a horror author and longtime listener to Dark Discussions. If you're new to the podcast, this is a segment where I take a look at a slightly lesser known or obscure horror film and give it hopefully unbiased review, as usually I'm seeing the film for the first time. That is the case this week. This is the Animals Run Amok film Slugs, recently released through Arrow. So we'll dive right in and I will give you some back cover copy. It says, the townsfolk of a rural community are dying in strange and gruesome circumstances. Following the trail of horrifically mutilated cadavers, resident health inspector Mike Brady is on the case to piece together the mystery. He soon comes to a terrifying conclusion. Giant slugs are breeding in the sewers below, and they're making a meal of the locals! Exclamation point. That is a perfect synopsis, a simple synopsis for a very simple and really, really fun film. This is directed by Juan Picare Simone. I'm probably butchering that name. If you recognize it, that might be because he directed the classic Spanish slasher Pieces, which came out in 1982. This is, I believe, a mid-80s film, this one, so this came out after that. I've reviewed Pieces on the show before, and I know that's like a much-beloved classic, but for some reason it just doesn't do much for me. But this movie does a lot for me. in the 1980, or I should say like mid-70s to like 1990s, 75 to 1990, we had this sort of like horror boom with mass market horror paperbacks, because with the rise of people like Stephen King and Robert McCammon and Dean Koontz, a lot of these publishing houses were trying to sort of replicate that success. Some worked, some didn't. So there was a lot of crap being released pretty quickly, but it was a great time. I wish I'd lived through there. I was born at the tail end of that time, but you could find these crazy mass market paperbacks with just sort of like really gory in your face covers that we don't really see today, but you could find these at the corner drugstore, at the supermarkets, really anywhere. And the reason I bring this up is because this film, Slugs, is based on a mass market novel by the same name by Sean Hudson. I don't know if I've never really heard anyone say his name, but it's that's Sean, Hutson. So Hudson, I'm not sure, but he was sort of big with sort of the creatures run amok, sort of slimy bugs and all sorts of stuff. And like I said, that was really popular during this time. You had slugs, you had evil cadaver worms, there were frogs, there was a series of crab books that was really popular. So you had all these sort of like nature run amok, insectoid, slithery creatures. And while I haven't read the novel, Slugs, I do have it, and I can tell if it's anything like this movie. It's really, really good, because this movie is really, really good. I think what happens a lot of times is during this time period, these mass market books with these creatures run amok, they were really, really fun. They weren't necessarily groundbreaking or amazing, but they were fun, quick reads. And the problem with that is I don't think creatures run amok movies always work that well. And I'll give a prime example is Squirm from Scream Factory, which I recently reviewed maybe a couple of months ago. I thought that movie was kind of close to garbage. And the flaw with that was you had all these sort of like sandworms that would pile up, but they never really seemed that menacing. It seemed like you could quickly run away from them. Slugs is a great counterpoint to that, because these even though they're just, you know, kind of tiny slugs the size of your like index finger, they seem very, very menacing. And that a big reason of that is because they go into the science behind it. It's still sort of ridiculous. You have to suspend your disbelief that slugs could sort of eat humans and quickly. But they kind of give a scientific basis with this whole acid thing and these several rows of teeth that appear on the bottom of the slugs that you almost can kind of believe it much easier than harmless sandworms killing a whole town of people. And really that's all there is to this film, and that's not a bad thing. But we get several scenes of sort of peripheral characters that are only introduced to then set up an elaborate kill scene. But the kills are just so phenomenal in this movie that it carries the whole film. The gore is absolutely fantastic. The blood is bright red. It reminds me of Giallo films from the 70s, which if you've listened to the segment for a while, you know I absolutely adore. So this movie is sort of like Final Destination in that it is all about the setup and the payoff for the kills, and they are absolutely glorious. Like I said, not to keep comparing it to Squirm, but it just works better for me because these things are just more menacing. Even when you just see them, like there are several scenes where a scientist is studying them, trying to figure out what the heck's going on, trying to come up with a way to kill them. There's one scene, for instance, where he's slicing up one of the slugs and one kind of gets out of the jar. He doesn't notice, and it goes into a cage and eats a hamster. And it shows you like these things are menacing. If they can take down a hamster, just one, which is like three times the size of it. When we get to later scenes in the film where there are just piles of them, you really get the sense that, like, yeah, I would not want to come to face-to-face with these slugs in real life, assuming a slug has a face. I don't really know. But the point of the matter is it just does a great job of saying, like, this is a ridiculous premise, but just, like, work with me for a while. We're going to introduce the science behind it, and the kills are going to be so good that by the end of it, you're going to be like, yeah, I can see why that these things would be, like, an actual menace. And I think that's a testament to the director, Juan Simone. And like I said, while I don't care for Pieces and I understand it's a classic, I think this movie is far superior. It is just so great. And I think it's a perfect example of how to do a creatures run amok film the right way. So if you didn't like Squirm like me, but you want something similar, it's actually done and executed excellently. Check out Slugs from Arrow. It's recently released. Say that five times fast. And yeah, Arrow's been killing it. Their transfers are always amazing. This film looks much better than it even needs to. So yeah, crisp, clear image. The sound is great. The dubbing is a little bit questionable in parts. It seems like some of the main characters aren't dubbed, but others are. So I'm assuming, similar to Pieces, they used a lot of, Spanish actors who spoke English, but perhaps, not that well. So they dubbed it over with American actors. But it's serviceable. That definitely doesn't take you out of the film. As far as special features, you get some interviews with the special effects guy, with some of the stars. They're not overly great, kind of like subpar compared to some of the Arrow special features, but the movie is so good, totally makes up for it. So forget I said anything. You should still buy this movie. It is so great. And that is Slugs from Arrow, another A+ this week. It's just been a gold mine with films these past few weeks, but definitely check it out. It is, I think, one of the best Creatures Run Amok movies I have ever seen. And check out the book on which it's based, Slugs by Sean Hudson. I have it as well, and I think I need to go find it and read it based solely on its adaptation. So, yes, yeah, Slugs gets a high recommendation from me this week. Yeah, that's it for this week. As always, if you have a suggestion of another slightly lesser known or obscure horror film, let the guys know on the Facebook group. Or hit them up at darkdiscussions@aol.com if I haven't seen it, or maybe even if I have and haven't seen it for a while, I will add it to the growing pile. A lot of the films coming up in the coming weeks are from Arrow, just because they're doing such a bang-up job of releasing these excellent lesser-known films that fit perfectly with Terror Tantrums. One last bit, shameless self-promotion time. As I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, I am a horror author. My first novel, Dreamwoods, came out earlier this month, October 1st, and that is a haunted amusement park novel. I've been pitching it as The Shining if it took place at Disney World. It's getting a lot of good press. I, along with Phil, was at this past weekend, as of this recording, at Rock and Shock, and I actually sold out at the convention by the morning of the third day, so... That warmed my heart. If that at all sounds interesting to you, you can find it right on Amazon. That's Dreamwoods, D-R-E-A-M, Woods, W-O-O-D-S. And I definitely appreciate you checking out, but no pressure, of course. As always, my name is Patrick Lacey, and until then, until next time, I'll see you.
All right, we're back. With all that stated, I guess we can get into our topic tonight, and the reason we're doing it is because it's a 40th anniversary of this film, and it's coming out on a 40th anniversary new 2D Blu-ray coming out October 15th, I think, and it is going to be re-released at theaters for 2 weeks, and I think, Chrissy, you're going to actually see it at the theater. But before we get into all that, Eric, what do everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
All right. Tonight we're going to be discussing the Robert De Niro, Martin Scorsese film, Taxi Driver.
That's right. And also Paul Schrader, Taxi Driver. I must add Paul Schrader to that.
Second call, 404 Hamilton, 417.
1-9-5. Now final, 448. De Niro. 4-5. In Bang the Drum Slowly, the critics called him a brilliant new talent. After Mean Streets, they said he was a genius. For his performance in The Godfather Part II, they gave him the Academy Award.
Come on, man. Just get me out of here, all right?
Now, Robert De Niro creates a terrifying portrait of life on the edge of madness.
Tabby, just forget about this. It's nothing.
Taxi Driver, a film by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, people do anything in front of a taxi driver. I mean anything. People too cheap to rent a hotel room.
Oh, driver, hurry up, will you?
People want to embarrass you. It's like you're not even there. It's like, you know, like a taxi driver doesn't even exist.
This city here is like an open sewer, you know? It's full of filth and scum.
I think I know what you mean, Travis. But it's not going to be easy.
When you guys get to be a Secret Service man?
What?
Well, I was just curious because I thought maybe I'd make a good one.
Hey, what kind of guns do you guys carry?
38s, 45s, 357 Magnums, something bigger maybe.
Hi, I'd like to volunteer.
Why?
Why? Because I think that you are the most beautiful woman I've ever seen.
The taxi driver is looking for a target. Getting ready. Getting organized. Preparing himself for the only moment in his life that will ever mean anything.
How much for everything?
$350 for the Magnum, $250 for the .38, $1.25 for the .25, $150 for the .38.
That taxi driver's been staring at us.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I don't know who's weirder, you or me.
You talking to me? Well, who the hell else are you talking? Talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
I don't believe I've ever met anyone quite like you.
Oh, yeah?
You will never see a more chilling performance than this. Robert De Niro in Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Jodie Foster, Albert Brooks, Harvey Keitel, Leonard Harris, Peter Boyle, Sybil Shepherd, Taxi Driver.
But yes, Taxi Driver, 1976 film. I would state that this is arguably one of my top five favorite films of all time. So you could argue that this may be, in my opinion, the best film we will ever have reviewed up to date, the 5 years we've been doing this podcast. But that's just my personal opinion. A couple of people behind the film and in front of the camera. So we got, first off, the screenwriter. Screenwriter is the great Paul Schrader, also known for a number of fantastic directorial efforts as well. Paul Schrader, I have to say, is arguably my favorite screenwriter of all time. I love all his work. Mostly, there's a couple of duds like everybody puts out. And a lot of his directorial efforts as well, including a number of Academy Award nominations. And he is actually an Academy Award winner. I did discover yesterday for the first time that he's completely different than I thought. I was talking to Mike online. I actually thought he was a German Jewish descent from New York City, but he's actually from Michigan and he's Dutch and a Calvinist. I was completely lost. I should know these things. I'm very disappointed with myself since these are things that I should know, especially someone that I consider the best, but I apologize. Eric, please forgive me.
I don't apologize to me. I apologize to him.
Yeah. So that's Paul Schrader, the writer. The director, Martin Scorsese. Everybody knows him, an Academy Award winner. Number of classic films. And he actually has a handful of films, including this one. And Raging Bull is two of the greatest films of all time, which Paul Schrader did write, co-write Raging Bull as well. And then we have the actors. It's a pretty damn good cast. Robert De Niro obviously stars as the anti-hero, Travis Bickle. Jodie Foster plays Iris. Harvey Keitel, Peter Boyle, and Sybil Shepherd makes a great impression in this film. And then, of course, someone that I was a bit surprised, Albert Brooks. I've seen this film so many times, and I never got the connection that that was Albert Brooks that played the character that we'll discuss later in the film until I watched the documentary and I said, sorry, Albert Brooks. I go, oh, that's Albert Brooks. So let's go around how we heard about this film. I doubt any of us were lucky enough to see it in the theaters in our personal opinion of the film and whatnot. So, Eric, why don't we start with you? I know you actually have the first rendition deluxe Blu-ray, even though I guess it's now going to be replaced by the 40th anniversary.
The newer deluxer version, yeah. It was actually given to me as a gift by my friend Dan for my birthday 1 year. So I wanted to get a chance to go through all the special features on it. Unfortunately, life is such I didn't get a chance to actually do that, but I did get a chance to watch the movie again. I don't know exactly what the first time I heard of the movie was, but of course everybody knows the whole "you talking to me," and that's probably how I became acquainted with the film, is by hearing people do that line and then not knowing where it was from and having them be like, "Oh my God, you've never seen Taxi Driver." So yeah, it's a classic. There's a reason it's a classic, and we're going to talk about it.
All right, very good, very good. For me, I actually I was a big horror fan as a kid, you know, creature feature, things like that. I also was a big fan of classic movies, especially my mother was a huge movie fan, and I loved talking films with her to the point where my friends thought I was eccentric. And then one day, after supper, my parents were watching some crappy television show in another room, so I went to their bedroom. I was like 10 years old, and Taxi Driver was the featured film on the Movie Loft on Channel 38 in Boston. They used to play numerous classic films, and I've seen a number of them off that station on the Movie Loft, and another one was Poseidon Adventure and so forth. So they had a lot of damn good films, and I saw that Robert De Niro was in it. I liked Robert De Niro from Godfather 2, and I said, oh, take a peek. 10 years old. It looked pretty cool. A lot of violence in the little trailer they were showing, in the You Talking to Me comment and all the other stuff. So I sat down, watched it on the cut version. I have no idea what differences were. And I absolutely thought the film was top notch, one of the best films I ever saw at the age of 10. I don't know if my parents even knew about it, but I think I told them the next day, and rather than tisking me, they said, oh, that's a great film. And so, yeah, I have to say it's one of the most important films in my lifetime, and it was probably the first film that actually brought me into the gritty feel of an anti-hero and man against the world type stuff that I pretty much fawned me as a artist. So, quote unquote artist. So, yeah, I think this movie is the best. Probably the fifth, my fifth favorite film, I think. Fifth or sixth, somewhere in there. Let's go with Chrissy.
Well, I owe my experience with this film to my housemate. I moved into his house in the late 1990s after I got divorced. And my experience with film at that point in my life was so freaking lame. I mean, so lame. I had seen nothing that was decent. I didn't really know what good film was. And he set me straight. He showed me all the dark classics, Repulsion, Taxi Driver, The Godfather, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 2001, Barry Lyndon, The Shining. I mean, I just saw so much great stuff, because of my housemate Charles. And all of these films I originally saw on Laserdisc because he had a massive, and still does, has a massive Laserdisc collection. He's also the person who turned me on to the idea of special features. He lived in LA for probably two or three decades. He is a lot older than me. For those of you who don't know, he's about 30 years older than me. And he's just a film whore, and he knows good film when he sees it, and he also knows good scores too, because he's a musician. So I saw it years ago. And then when we were going to go see it in the movie, he's like, let's start, you know, watching all the special features. So we dragged the disc out again, and we rewatched it last night, and I was reminded of what a fantastic piece of art this is. So anyway, that's how I learned about it. I didn't learn about it until I was in my late 20s. So.
All right, very good. What about you, Abe?
I've heard about this film for a long time, but I've never had a chance to see it. What's funny about this is that during a semester in my French to Wave course, my professor had used the film as an example of certain artistic directions and techniques. One of the shots he's showing was our main character looking at the seltzer and the bubbles in one of his drinks.
Oh, yeah.
That's
a good scene.
And so it was very shocking, surprised when I texted you to find out what we were going to do for an episode and trying to be Taxi Driver. So this was actually the very first time I've seen it, not the first time I've heard of it, of course. The film is absolutely fantastic, in my opinion. It's got an incredible sense of style, a very noir kind of sense of mood. The performances are all around very good, and it's very versatile. in both. It's raw drama, both psychological and it's violence. Even though it's not a gore fest. Even though the final confrontation of the film is surprisingly one of the most raw I've seen, and because it's the second only scene of actual violence, yet it's done so well, even though it's so short, that it's so impactful. And you know, I thought De Niro was fantastic. I mean, all the films I've seen, man, he's great. But this is so different from what I'm usually used to seeing him in. And I love psychological thrillers, and this was no exception to the at all. So I was very happy to see this, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking about this tonight.
All right, very good, Mike.
Yes.
Where did you hear about this film? How did you see it first? And what's your opinion?
This came out in 76, correct? So
that's right.
So I don't know if I heard about – I would have been six when it was released, five or six, depending on the time of the year. So it's probably just a film that was one of those always in the background. The people talk about movies. You'd hear about it. And I was aware of it to some degree, but you know, 6-year-olds usually aren't really into a movie like Taxi Driver.
Except Phil Perrin.
Except maybe Phil. Okay. Which would probably, you know, explain the lack of Taxi Driver action figures in Toys R Us. But, you know, by the time I think I finally got around to seeing it, I'm pretty sure it was when I was in college. And I've only seen it, I saw it once in college and probably saw it once since then. So this was probably only my third watch of the film. And it's a strong film. It's an actor's film, I think. And I guess a writer's film. It's not something that, like Scorsese is, you know, occasionally known for his stylistic flourishes. Think of the tracking shot in Goodfellas, which is notorious now. And really, oh, yeah. But he knows how to tell a story, and he's smart enough and confident enough to let the actors do their work. It's not that it's a poorly directed film by any means, but the direction doesn't call attention to itself until really the final one of the final shot of the film. But the you do get that one long tracking shot in the aftermath the rampage at the end. But that's like the only place where it's clearly, well, I might get maybe one or two other places where the director is sort of pointing to himself, and everything else is just letting the story play out and watching this character, you know, go sort of further and further down a rabbit hole. And this is one of those series of films that's made in New York in the 1970s that to me captures New York so very, very well. The sights and the sounds of New York City in a way that I don't think a lot of modern films do, especially since a lot of modern films set New York and Toronto.
That's true.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
But no, I moved out of New York City when I was five. I turned five the next day. We moved upstate. But my father worked in New York City until I was in college, so I'd often gone down there and visited, or we'd go see like the Rockefeller Center show or Radio City Music Hall or something like that. And so I've always been comfortable down in the city, but I remember the city when it was a cesspool. It was a cesspool I was comfortable in, but it was still a cesspool. And this really captures that in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you, Mike. I grew up, you know, in Danbury. I've been here my whole life, but my parents were big theater people, and I remember them taking me down to see My Fair Lady, the revival with Rex Harrison on Broadway, because they took me to Broadway all the time. And what little I remember of being in New York City when I was 7 and 8 years old was that it was just a big, scary, very dirty place. And it's come a long way. I mean, I remember them walking me down the street and like I was crushed between them because there was just so much crime and so much stuff going on. And Charles, my housemate, remembers New York City too. And I think, there's actually an interesting feature on the Blu-ray. I don't know if it's on the new Blu-ray, but it's on the Blu-ray special edition that came out before this 40th anniversary release. I don't know if it has the same one because we haven't had time to compare them yet, although my housemate has both, where they actually show you a shot of here it is in the movie, here's what it looks like now. And it's pretty fascinating. It's definitely worth watching.
Well, it is weird for me to – I remember when I was in high school, we took several field trips to see Broadway shows. And it's amazing the teacher never got burned by this because he would literally just drop us off in Times Square. And this is not the Disney Rudy Giuliani, Mayor Bloomberg Times Square.
This was a scary Times Square. There were hookers everywhere.
This was the Mayor Koch Times Square. And you would say, okay, it's 12 o'clock. You chose at 2. You got an hour and a half. Go get lunch. And you just had to have a buddy to be with, a partner. And my partner was my friend Ralph, and he had never been in New York City before, so he wasn't going to do me any good. But, you know, you're walking around, and you've got, you know, pimps and junkies and whores and just everywhere. And we could do whatever we wanted
it's
for that 90 minutes.
And whores, oh, my.
Oh, my. Yeah. So I was trying to steer out of that, but I couldn't help it. I just fell right in. Anyway, I saw it coming.
Yeah, but it's true. And I think I feel sort of sad for those of us who didn't get that opportunity, even though we were really young, to see the transformation that New York City has gone through. If you've lived near here your whole life, like me and Mike kind of have, and you've been there all the time, you've seen the city really change. And as much as the Disney Times Square is nice and clean and it's fun and all of that, it's lost some of its elan a little bit just because the edge is off. They've almost made it like Disney World for New Yorkers or something.
Think of it this way. Then currently at New York Times Square, one of its features is the naked cowboy who is not naked and he's sort of a tourist attraction. You know,
and then they get the painted nude ladies.
Right. I mean, this isn't gross and disturbing. That's supposed to be gross and disturbing if it's in Times Square. There are people who are just, you know, got it a bit up their ass. I understand the nostalgia for that period, you know, for that period of New York, because if you grew up in it, or were familiar with it, it had a unique and distinct flavor, for lack of a better term. The new one is so much better for human beings to live in.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, it's you're not worried about, for the most part, not being about being worried about being raped or, you know, take my wife when she first went to New York City. I think when she first went to New York City, she went in high school as part of some band trip. They were playing. It might have been when they did the I don't remember what it was, but she credits. You remember the Guardian Angels?
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, Yeah. So she's there. She's walking around the streets of New York with one of her friends, and she credits, you know, them with. I think she was porched by a pimp or someone who was, I guess, fantasizing dragging them off and turning them into his own personal Princess Leia in metal bikini. But she credits the Guardian Angels with coming up and saving them from some idiot who was going to do something horrible to them. You know, that was the perception of the city at the time. Whether, you know, what was really going to happen, who knows? But that was it. You're always waiting for someone to jump out and mug you or rob you. And it's probably better that we don't live in that now. Eric and I just finished separately, but we finished watching the new Marvel series, Luke Cage, which is set in Harlem. And you compare what Harlem, which, you know, its reputation as a rough town, looks like in Luke Cage compared to what New York City looked like in 1976. And it's a very, very different place.
No, that's true. That's true. A lot of folks say 1970s, late 1960s, and even 1980s early films prior to Mayor Giuliani, America's mayor, one of the greatest men living today. Besides that fact, these films do have that time stamp or whatnot of a time that's gone by. So the grindhouses, the pimps, the hookers, the muggers, the druggies, the pawn stores, all that stuff that was very odd in places that you would now call Disney World, like Times Square. Times Square is now one of the greatest tourist places to visit, especially if you're into commercial things. While at one time it was a seedy place, you can see that in this film. You can see that in films like Midnight Cowboy, in Basket Case, the first film, for that matter. So it's it is interesting, the changes. So that alone makes the film a curiosity, even if it hadn't been a great film in the first place.
Oh, I would like to add this one thing, and then we'll move on. Did you hear that, Mike? Did you hear that? Oh God, I'm drawing a blank. The famous place is closing. I'm sorry.
The Carnegie Deli?
Thank you. Yes, Carnegie Deli is closing, and I was actually at the thought. Yes, and I was actually at the Howard Johnson's, the Howard Johnson's, the dumpy Howard Johnson's in Times Square. I was there the day that it closed. I had one of the last Manhattans at the Howard Johnson's in Times Square, but now the Carnegie Deli is closing, and there was a big article on it, and it's going to be sad. It was a tourist trap, but it's going to be sad. So
apparently people no longer are interested in tasty, fatty food with tons of salt. And
well, the last Jewish deli,
heart disease.
Last Jewish deli, Wolfie's in Miami Beach. That closed just about 4 years ago. So these things do happen. Nostalgia. And yet, you know, if you don't go to it, it goes out of business. So one other person I forgot to mention, and we do forgot to mention his name on the Psycho episode, too, until the very, 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 very end.
Bernie?
Yep, exactly. Bernard Herrmann. He did the music for this film. So that is actually his very last production. Before he passed away, he was actually unhealthy at the time, and he died, I think, a day or two after the film was closed for production. So
yeah, it was the next day. And it is one of our favorite scores here. We take it up to the cemetery for our cocktail parties. It's just very atmospheric and wonderful. So,
and Eric? And
he did actually have to be talked into doing this movie. He initially did not want to take the job because he thought the movie was too violent.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One, Bernard Herrmann, obviously, for some folks, would be considered a mainstream musician or scorer, I should say. And Martin Scorsese was a no-name at this time. He had only done a couple of independent films and one film for Roger Corman, Boxcar Bertha, which actually just came out on Blu-ray this week. By Twilight. And so he wasn't well known, and Bernard Herrmann, along with the violence in the film, was also kind of like, who the hell is this Martin Scorsese guy? And it sounds stupid. A taxi driver? I don't do films about taxi drivers. And that was the actual quote from, not by him, but by, I think, Paul Schrader in the documentary that's on my DVD that I have. So yeah, but he was talked into it after. I'm not sure why. Eric, did you get the reason why he finally said, "Yeah, I'll do it"? I forget what happened.
I think the script went through a couple revisions, and eventually he was like, "Oh, okay, this version seems like something I'm willing to have my name attached to."
Yeah, there you go. And the score is pretty damn good, as always.
Apparently the film was partially, according to a little bit of trivia I'm reading here, that it was partially autobiographical on the part of a Schrader, who went through some bad times in his life, and did some of the patterns and kind of frank films and some of the pitfalls that our main character does, which kind of. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add to that, Abe, which is, yeah, that's true. Basically, Paul Schrader, at the time when he wrote this, had broken up with his girlfriend, landed up on the street, and was technically homeless for a week, and then moved in with somebody and wrote this based off of experiences of what he saw on the street. Originally, the screenplay took place in L.A., And when Scorsese got involved, he asked Schrader if he could transfer locations to New York City, and Schrader obliged. And so you're absolutely right, Abe. It was somewhat biographical, not that Paul Schrader did any of these things in this film, but he saw these type of things, at least.
Not that he can admit.
Yeah, well, that's a fair point. Well, he didn't kill anybody, put it that way.
Or did he?
Or did he? So yeah, that's actually a good point, Abe. We'll get into some of the interesting scenes based around the quote unquote seedy New York City that we see in this film. So Eric, why don't you throw up a wiki and let
us
know about the plot? Yeah.
All right. A mentally unstable Vietnam War veteran works as a nighttime taxi driver in New York City, where the perceived decadence and sleaze feeds his urge for violent action, attempting to save a pre-adolescent prostitute in the process.
Yes. And what was the first line? Could you repeat that, Eric?
A mentally unstable Vietnam War veteran.
You think? yes, that's right. At this time, I guess we can throw up a spoiler alert and we'll just talk about anything and anything.
Or as Phil would refer to him, a mental health person.
Yes, a person with behavioral health issues. Yes. We'll throw up the spoiler alert. Again, this is a 40-year-old film, so a lot of folks have probably seen this film. However, if you haven't.
Spoiler alert, he drives a taxi.
Yes, there you go. Yes. Anytime, anywhere. Will you work Jewish holidays? Anytime, anywhere.
How do you answer that?
So what do you want to hack for, Bickle?
I can't sleep nights.
This porn up there just for that.
Yeah, I know. I tried that.
So what do you do now?
Ride around nights mostly. Subways, buses. Figure, you know, if I'm going to do that, I might as well get paid for it.
Want to work uptown nights? South Bronx? Harlem?
I work anytime, anywhere.
Will you work Jewish holidays?
Anytime, anywhere.
All right, let me see your chauffeur's license. How's your driving record?
It's clean. It's real clean, like my conscience.
Are you going to break my chops? Don't trouble with guys like you coming in and break my chops all the time. If you're going to break my chops, you can take it on the Arches right now. You understand?
I love that.
I think Hill may have seen this movie more than once.
Hill, you pick up the spooks.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. I was laughing my butt off.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
I've seen this story so many times. It's so disgusting. I like know all the words and lines and all that. To the point where I told the story. I think it was to you, Eric. I was working on my printer. We got a new printer, installing it this weekend, and my wife walks in during a certain scene, and I'm not really even paying attention, but I immediately know what it is. And I go, and I know the words. I go, you may want to cover your ears because they're about to use the word that Donald Trump used. In that 11-year-old video. So, yeah, that's about to happen. So, yeah. So, yeah, I've seen this film way too many times. Spoiler alert's up. So we'll discuss whatever we want. So, it's a guy. We don't know too much about him. I never really got the connection that he was a Vietnam vet. Obviously they say that at the beginning. He says that he was a Marine, whatever. But it really isn't a Vietnam vet film, even if the character happened to be a Marine that happened to be in Vietnam. It was only after watching the documentary that I could see that, okay, that could be partly why he went kooks. But we don't really know much about him, right? We don't know where he's from.
No, everything's pretty much left in mystery. I mean, the only thing that could pertain to is his service to the Marines is what he says to the characters, and one scar we see in a few moments when he has his shirt off. But even the story about that is questionable as well.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So the first scene of the film, he goes and sees the great Joe Spinell playing a cameo in this film as the head of the taxi dispatcher. And De Niro wants to work. Basically says that he doesn't sleep, so why not just drive around? Because what he's doing now, based off of what he says, is he's doing subways and walking the streets at midnight. And Spinell says, well, all right, if as long as you're willing to work Jewish holidays and go anywhere, you're hired. And then he was not going to hire him at first, but when he found out he was a Marine, you know how Marines are, you know, hey, we're part of the club. So, yeah, all right.
Semper Fi.
That's right. So, Mike, you were about to say something. I heard you about the – you breathed in as if you were going to say something.
Yeah, well, I was just saying it's – The Vietnam, the vet thing, it said he's a vet, he's a Vietnam vet, would make sense given that this is just a couple of years after,
yeah, the era.
After the war ended. Yeah. So just as if you would saw someone now who there's a good chance you could expect them to have seen some service at some point overseas. But I think it mostly just informs some of his talents later on in the film, his ability, you know, his comfort with firearms, for example.
Yeah.
And just makes a little bit more sense. Gives him, but it's not really something that's dominant. It's not in your face. And in doing some of my research, some people had questioned whether or not he really was a vet. Yep. And apparently Scorsese has there. And there's a few things like that in the film where there's questioning: is it something that really happened or not? And basically, Scorsese has scuttled any talk of him lying about being a vet or the ending, which we can get to later. The ending, some people thought might have been a dream, and he said, no, the ending happened.
Yeah, Schrader backed that up too, Mike. He said the exact same thing. Schrader basically applied that he wouldn't have got the job if he lied and they find out, oh, you're not a vet. Not that this place would have been something that probably would have done a great background check anyway. But he pretty much squashed both things as well, Mike, that the ending may have been a Jacob's Ladder type thing, and this scene here was him just lying, and so both him and Scorsese have kind of squashed that. So, but it was a curiosity because even Roger Ebert was the one that was saying some of these things, making these suggestions in his critique of the film.
But it is so incidental, I guess you could argue, or unimportant, that you could just as easily see this as a lie, right? It wouldn't really change his character much. It wouldn't change the film much. It's not that central. And it would be one way to read or interpret the film, I guess, if you wanted to.
Yep, that's right. Exactly. It could be that way because I remember reading Roger Ebert's article about some of these ideas, and they do make sense. Again, it could be open-ended. However, I guess that's pretty much been squashed since Schrader and Scorsese have both come out and said they're just imaginations by these critics.
Do we know where this film falls in the timeline of the vigilante film series? You know, things like Death Wish and Dirty Harry.
You know, well, Dirty Harry was either 69 or 70, so that was very much early. Death Wish with Charles Bronson, by the way, who's a Lithuanian-American, he actually did that in 74. So this is actually quite late in these vigilante films. Eric, you're going to say something.
No, I was just going to say that I thought about that while I was watching a movie and then forgot to look it up.
Okay. It seems like it's one of the later entrees to this subgenre.
And I imagine I may be misremembering, but that Travis Bickle probably spoke to people in the wrong way, somewhat in the audience.
Well, it did in one case. Someone that assassinated Ronald Reagan. Continue.
But I'm thinking, people who would have been Travis Bickle for president shirts. It's sort of like Archie Bunker in All in the Family.
Yeah.
Was that Norman Lear, the last thing he expected was for so many people to love Archie Bunker because he was set up to be, because Norman Lear was a big lefty, and he was sort of set up to be the conservative buffoon, and he didn't realize how much of the conservative audience watching the show would agree with Archie Bunker. And I'm not sure, and I don't think that this was intended to be quite as political, despite the setting of the film around a presidential campaign. I don't know that Schrader would have found or would have expected Travis Bickle to be quite the cathartic outlet for a lot of people because the crime was so bad. And we would see this play come to play in real life with Bernie Goetz in, I think, 1983 or 1984, where he shot a couple of people who tried to rob him on the subway.
Yes, I do remember that. I was thinking of this, Mike. For example, the Reverend Jimmy Swaggart, one of the many reverends that screwed up and became jokes because they were having sex with other people and all this, and they were preaching God and all that stuff. And I read somewhere once in an article about these people that even though these people are sinners and they did terrible things and they cheated on their wives and they were lying to their congregations, some of their stuff that they say is still right, that, you know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt, you know, on and on. So the sinner can still say the stuff that's not bad. So I was looking at Travis Bickle as, or even Archie Bunker as that example, is that even though they're hugely flawed and most certainly you could argue shouldn't be role models, especially Travis Bickle because of what he was going to do and what he did, but they still have enough in them that people could relate to them because they're a mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, like there's another example, the guy from Network.
Speaking of another classic movie from the 1970s, yes.
Yeah, so there's a lot of these flawed characters in literature and film that aren't necessarily someone you would want to be, but have a lot to say that people can relate to. And therefore, they become cult heroes, even if they're fictional, even if they're bad, because some of the things they say or do work.
Yeah, this actually makes me think of the character of Tony Montana from Scarface. For some reason, despite being a drug dealer, gang leader, you know, all around pretty scummy character, he's almost been idolized by certain young people. I've noticed. You know, it's like, especially in like the rap genre and stuff like that. You see kids walking around with Tony Montana shirts and stuff like that, associating with being, you know, powerful and stuff like that. Even though his lifestyle is and his actions are, from what most of us would consider to be abhorrent and unlawful.
Yeah.
Well, these characters appeal to, like you were just saying, Phil. We relate to them. And like Abe was just saying, you know, there are young kids who relate to Joey Montana. The thing is with characters like this, we can relate to them because we're not really allowed to be them in society. So in ways they become surrogates for things that we really can't be. And that's really the key. I rewatched, thank you, Patrick Ray. I have to give him a shout out. He sent me the private link to his little short called The Hourglass Figure, which I loved. He's going to be distributing it, or it's going to get distributed or something on a DVD or whatever. So he had to kind of just take it down and make it private. The Hourglass Figure is about a desperate stay-at-home mom who hates her family. And that's why that short is so successful, because there are so many women out there who are just frustrated with their families, and yet they can't express that.
Well, Chrissy,
I think that was the secret with Archie Bunker. You know, he said all that shocking stuff that all of us really wanted to say and can't because of societal constraints. So I think that's another issue here, and that's kind of what you're dealing with.
And with Bickle, the frustration, even if he's doing it half the time because he has no idea why, because he's insane, but I mean, people are sick and tired of the fake politician who's lying to us, or people are sick and tired of as Mike was mentioning, and you, Chrissy, were mentioning that the streets are filthy, dirty. Mike's wife, when she was single, could have been abducted. I mean, where people are sick and tired of it, and this is what Bickle's saying, and Bickle, and then when he goes up to Sybil Shepherd's character, and she seems like she's the happy and jolly person, and he says, I know how you feel with all this crap on your desk. You're still alone out there and people are alienated. It's the 70s. People are sick and tired of the bullshit. And that's why I think he became a cult hero to so many, similar to Bilbo Baggins or the example that Abe did with the guy from Scarface, Joe Buck and Ratso Rizzo from Midnight Cowboy. I mean, I think that people are just sick and tired, and they symbolize the anger and frustration of being stuck.
Well, people
good thing
are
nobody
sick
feels
and
that way anymore.
Right. People are sick and tired of being sick and tired. And this is kind of where, like you just said, Phil, they get to that point. And yet it was interesting because last night when we were watching Taxi Driver, and every conversation that Travis had, like when he finally gets Palantine in the car, and he's like, well, what do you think? And he just like spews all this stuff that is so out there. Like, you can clearly see it's very uncomfortable.
And he's
for
right.
The Secret Service guy. He's right. But again, nobody wants to confront that. And that's why these characters become charming, or they become anti-heroes in a sense, because they do the things that we can't. So.
Or that's right. Rather
should is what you're saying. Fight the power, rage against the machine.
Right. But you know, the whole thing about raging against the machine and saying what you want to say and speaking your mind. You know, you have to wonder sometimes, when is it just going to finally be okay to just be what you are and who you are? And it's never okay. And it's never okay. There's always something holding you back. There always is, whether it's personal or whatever. There's always something.
I'm sure Eric would agree that some of the folks, we would hope they would never show who they are based off of their stupidity as people. but I generally I do understand exactly what you're saying, yeah, Chrissy, because people think they're stuck in the world for whatever reasons. And Travis Bickle, for whatever reasons, at that time in 1976, hit a vein and boom, he blew up.
Well, go ahead.
I said, remember, part of the reason people get fed up with this stuff is because they watch it on TV or now on Facebook, or every little thing gets blown up into some fucking drama. Reality is that most of us, if we didn't know what the hell was going outside our own lives, we wouldn't have any reason to be frustrated. I mean, we'd have our little daily frustrations,
yep,
and our issues, but most of us are not walking out of the house and getting mugged.
No.
You know, or.
And that's another thing too. I think social media has opened that up, where, you know, we are constantly exposed to the barrage of whatever and other people's thoughts all day long, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But it's also not necessarily a good thing either, because in the 70s, you didn't have social media telling you what to think about, for example, Vietnam vets. I think part of the reason this movie is very powerful is because it's talking about what was a very raw subject in the early 70s. It was before we really knew what PTSD was. It was before all of that. It was really looking at a person who, even though, like you said, it was not directly stated, it was implied. And a lot of people in the 70s, my father had friends who were Vietnam vets, and they would come over to the house and drink beer with them. And believe me, there was stuff that was off with them. They were off. And it was just that topic. It was that skeleton in the closet. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Nobody wanted to know what was going on. And I think the reason that this movie was so groundbreaking is because it kind of addressed that issue that nobody wanted to talk about in their own neighborhoods. They didn't have social media to come on and say, hey, you know, Richie Gunn came home last night from Vietnam or whatever, and he is definitely, you know, way out there and whatever, and there's definitely something wrong going on. That was the stuff that was discussed on the phone between the wives with your neighbors. It wasn't on social media. Scorsese, with this film, addressed an issue that everybody, I think, in the mid-70s was thinking, but nobody could talk about, because it wasn't discussed in polite society. You didn't talk about that. You just didn't. So.
Yeah. No. Well, let me bring this up because it's a major plot point to the film that brings one character around by the end, and that's the Sybil Shepherd character. The Sybil Shepherd's character, she plays a campaign volunteer, so one of those young 20-somethings that are
still have hope.
Yeah, yeah. What's that word that people say that they have hope?
Idealistic?
Idealistic, yeah. Yeah, or foolish, Eric. That works, too. And she plays a character named Betsy. And, you know, she seems like a jolly soul, how she hangs out at the campaign office in a damn good location in Manhattan. And what happens is that Travis Bickle sees her on the street, real beautiful girl, and he gets a fancy for her. And so,
stalker.
I wouldn't go that far.
I would absolutely.
I would say that he saw this good-looking woman, and saw where she walked into, and he said, "I want to ask that."
And
chick
started to watch her there every day.
Well, that was stalker. Well, either way, he's watching her, and this is when he comes to this conclusion that she's a lonely person, even though what we see, she's not a lonely person. She seems pretty jolly and happy with her life. And so he eventually walks in there, and he says he wants to volunteer, and the Albert Brooks character says, "Okay, I'll take you over here." And he goes, "No, I want to volunteer to her. If you don't mind." And she knows immediately, okay, this guy has the hots for me. And she looks at him, and he's a well-dressed guy. You know, he seems normal. He talks normal. And then he says his artistic, prophetic spiel about how you're a lonely person, and I can see that. In other words, he's pulling things out from in her. So he, even though a lot of damaged people or artistic people, they say, can see things more differently or more clearly than others.
Phil, I'm sorry. I'm honestly not trying to make fun of you, but did you mean artistic or autistic?
Artistic. Artistic.
Okay. All right.
Even though he's mentally deranged, I think.
Okay, but he is a little bit Asperger's with those conversations. Sorry, yeah. I will go there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's very awkward.
But my point is that he sees the world differently than the rest of us, because he's damaged. And so he sees things a little differently. And when he states these things, at least as the Sybil Shepherd character, she sees him describing her. And she's like amazed.
Hi. I'd like to volunteer.
Great. I'll take you right over here.
That's all right. I'd rather volunteer to her if you don't mind.
And why do you feel that you have to volunteer to me?
Because I think that you are the most beautiful woman I've ever seen.
Thanks. But what do you think of Palantine? Charles Palantine, the man you're volunteering to help elect president.
Well, I'm sure he'll make a good president. I don't know exactly what his policies are, but I'm sure he'll make a good one.
You want a canvas?
Yeah, I'll canvas.
How do you feel about the senator's stand on welfare?
I don't really know the senator's stand on welfare, but I'm sure it's a good stand.
You sure though?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, it's weird because in this one scene, he is so different than he is in pretty much the entire rest of the film.
Right.
He is. This is clearly something he's practiced.
Sure.
But he comes across as your alpha male stepping in there, right? You know, coming in, sweeping in, taking power, and, hey, babe, I want you, and you want me, and we're going to go out, and we're going to have lunch at 4 o'clock. Come see me for some coffee.
I would not state it that way, Mike. I don't think it was as gender-specific as you claim. I think it was just a guy that, like you said, he's completely different than usual. So I thought of him as more of a normal person, making a play for a woman if she
but you compare him to the Albert Brooks character,
yeah,
who's
know, because it's Albert Brooks.
Yeah, he's a total douche.
Is a bit is a bit nebbishy, right? He's kind of, you know, he's a little bit more awkward with her. He doesn't have the same sort of confidence that Travis is exhibiting at that moment. But that's pretty much all he has in the tank. Because once he goes on a date with her, you know, it's suddenly awkward.
Well, no, the first date, the coffee date, goes excellent because he keeps on spilling the shit out about her. And she comes up with that great, great quote by a poetic genius named Kris Kristofferson, who one of the greatest songwriters of all time, with a line from one of his songs.
You mean like being a walking contradiction?
Yeah, that line.
Can I ask something? When he's making the jokes, well, I think making the joke with her, how he has to get the sign that says I'm organized?
Yes. Oh, yeah, what about it? Yeah, that's a good one.
I wasn't entirely sure if he knew that it was a joke.
He had the sign on his wall.
Right, but does he understand the sign's supposed to be funny?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just wondering.
Well, I don't know, Mike. I think he thinks maybe you're right. I see Eric's point, but I see your point too, which maybe he actually thinks it is a valid philosophical point based off of his mindscape. And when he says it to her, she brings up, oh, you mean like something else, like baby on board sticker or something like that. And he gets confused.
Well, it's
and stops, and yeah, and he's like, awkward moment, and he changes the subject. Yeah, but you're going to say something like,
well, I say because sometimes if you do have people, and I agree with Christy that he's got a little bit of Asperger's or PTSD, they sometimes do have trouble picking up things like sarcasm and humor.
They definitely do.
They have
issues with the social cues. That's the whole thing about it. They can't pick up on subtle cues.
All right, and I got the quote. The quote from the Kris Kristofferson song. It's called Pilgrim Chapter 33 is the song.
Started writing this song about Chris Gantry. End up writing about Dennis Hopper and Johnny Cash. Norman, Norbert, Funky Donnie Frid, Billy Swan, Bobby Newirth, Jerry Jeff Walker, and Paul Siebel. Ramblin' Jack Elliott had a lot to do with it. See him wasted on the sidewalk in his jacket and his jeans, wearing yesterday's misfortunes like a smile. Once he had a future full of money, love, and dreams, which he spent like they was going out of style. And he keeps right on a change, for the better or the worse, searching for a shrine he's never found. Never knowing if believing is a blessing or a curse, or if the going up was worth the coming down. He's a poet, and he's a picker, he's a prophet, he's a pusher. He's a pilgrim and a preacher, and the problem when he's stoned, he's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction, taking every wrong direction on his lonely way back home. He has tasted good and evil in your bedrooms and your bars, and he's traded in tomorrow for today, running from his devil's lord, reaching for the stars, losing all the love along the way. But if this world keeps right on turning, for the better or the worse, and all he ever gets is older and around. From the rocking of the cradle to the rolling of the hearse, the going up was worth coming down. He's a poet, he's a picker, he's a prophet, he's a pusher. He's a pilgrim and a preacher and a problem when it's stone. He's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction.
taking every wrong direction on his lonely way back home. There's a lot of wrong directions on that lonely way back home.
She says to him, you know what? You remind me of this lyric from Kris Kristofferson. And she goes, he's a prophet, he's a pusher, partly truth and partly fiction, a walking contradiction. And obviously that was a compliment because, you know, she sees that he's actually has some intelligence there and he's, quote unquote, an artist, even if he's insane. And she doesn't know this yet. But then he's like you said, Chrissy, you know, if he has Asperger's, he doesn't get the symbolism or the sarcasm. And he goes, well, I've never pushed. I'm not a pusher. I don't do drugs. I don't push drugs. And she goes, no, not that part. The partly truth, partly fiction, a walking contradiction. He's a prophet. And I think still it goes over his head.
Sure. You know what you remind me of?
What?
That song by Kris Kristofferson.
Who's that?
The songwriter. He's a prophet. He's a prophet and a pusher. Partly truth, partly fiction. Walking contradiction.
You're saying that about me?
Well, who else would I be talking about?
I'm no pusher. I never have pushed.
No, just the part about the contradictions. You are that.
But at that point, they're on the same wavelength, and the date goes pretty damn good, and yet she's still a little ditzy too, because he goes, I want to take you out to a movie, and obviously that means, you know, like this weekend or whatever, but she goes, oh, I'm still working. I can't go now. And he goes, no, I mean later. And she goes, oh yeah, of course, you know. And the date goes well. It ends in quite well.
Yeah. The first date, not the movie date.
The first, no. That was terrible. Jesus Christ.
Well, and I did want to say something about some of the metaphor within the script. That's why the script is so brilliant. But first I'm going to say my housemate was so excited when he went into the movie theater and he got four candies, a popcorn, a soda, and a movie ticket for $1.85.
Oh my God. I said that to my wife too. I go, you know, like, how old this
my
film is.
Was like, I remembered when I used to spend $2.05 to get like a little bit more of that when I went to porn theaters in LA. And I'm like, thank you, TMI.
Well, it doesn't even matter that it's a porn. It doesn't even matter it's a porn theater. It's just the fact that you can buy four candies, a soda, and a popcorn for $1.85, and now that's like.
And there were some good candies in there, like Clark bars, Chuckles, yeah. Goobers.
They had some good shit.
Now
but,
it,
you know,
it's $35 for all that.
It still freaks me out that they used to show pornos in like actual movie theaters.
Oh yeah,
that's bizarre to me.
Yeah, but I mean the pornos too back then were different. They were different from the pornos we see now. I mean, this is why everybody makes jokes about 70s porn. I mean, in all honesty, my housemate has 70s porn. I've seen some of it. It is not – it's awesome. It's very entertaining. It is not the same kind of porn that we have now. It was different. It was cheesy. It was a little cloaked. In fact, a lot of
and
it was
yet,
cloaked.
And yet still and, entirely inappropriate for a date.
Yes, exactly. But my point is, there is definitely a difference. I can attest to it. I've seen it. Now, I've seen the difference between porn today and porn in the 70s, and wow.
Thank you, Christy, porn aficionado.
Yes.
Now,
and I'm the only woman in this group, but you guys gonna need to catch up.
Now,
seriously?
Now, I know Vinegar Syndrome is Scream Factory. They're actually HD, you know, 2HD on porn films.
Well, because that's what we want. We want 70s porn in HD.
A dick in HD because we don't see enough of that, but whatever.
So anyway, this is where the problem is that he does a normal thing, which is he finds out, oh, this girl that I like some band, or at least in his eyes, named Kris Kristofferson. So he goes out and buys the album with that song on it. And so he picks her up and he gives it to her. You know, that's a typical thing a guy would do on a second date. And he brings her to a theater. And that's the problem, right? He doesn't have a horse blinders, so he doesn't know the difference between a normal film and a porno film. He's just like clueless because he's mentally gone. I don't think he's intentionally being a jerk by bringing her there.
He had no idea that it was inappropriate.
Right.
You gotta be kidding.
What?
This is a dirty movie.
No, this is a movie that a lot of couples come to. All kinds of couples go here.
Sure about that?
Yeah. Yeah, I see them all the time. Come on.
And so he brings it there.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, he definitely has no, because he, one of the things he highlights a lot is his loneliness. He seems to have very little interaction with other people. So every conversation, even with guys, other taxi drivers, like in the cafe, are very uncomfortable because he rarely speaks at all. So he doesn't really know how to deal with people a lot of times. And he's probably had very few, if any, relationships. So this kind of experience is very alien to him.
That sums it up 100%, Abe. Absolutely. He's truly an island alone in this world, probably most likely due to his mental illness. But I have to say, Cybill Shepherd in this film, she was just absolutely fantastic, the acting. When they're in the theater, she's like, this is a dirty movie theater. And he goes, oh, no, normal people come here all the time. They bring their dates, whatever. And she goes, and then when the film comes on, her expressions, it's just hilarious. And she walks out on him. And then, of course, the typical thing, which is, she doesn't want the record, but he goes, oh, I bought it for you. And he goes, all right, fine. Now I got two of them, because anybody who likes Kris Kristofferson that much is going to have the album anyway. And so it just all backfires, and she walks out on him, basically. And what happens, it turns out that this lonely person he thought was someone that identified with him, in his eyes, is now part of the machine because she rejected him because he's an idiot.
Right. He immediately goes from you're an angel to you're going to burn in hell.
Right. Exactly.
And that is kind of one of the, I guess, the themes they're playing with, is that men see women tend to as either Madonnas or whores and don't have a whole lot of in between.
That's a good point, Mike, too. I looked at it as she became part of the machine in his eyes. Not that she's a woman that became a whore or in his eyes, but a woman who was not really anything but part of the machine that he hates so much. But Eric, you know what I'm saying?
I was just going to say, it's also kind of a typical guy thing. When you're, this was only the second date, so it wasn't a very long time for it to happen over, but I'm sure you've known people, if not done it yourself, dating somebody and you think they're the best and you're not seeing them anymore. And oh, that fucking bitch. It happens. So, yeah.
But you know what? I looked at all this as more than that. I mean, obviously I said she was part of the machine, but I was looking at him as a person based off of what he does with the Jodie Foster character. He looks at Cybill Shepherd as a person to save. I don't think it has anything to do truly with her gender. I mean, obviously she's pretty and obviously he wants to date her and whatnot, but I think he's more attracted to her because he thinks her feeling in life, based off of his creepy watching her, as you said, Eric, she's lonely, and therefore he and she are the same. And so he and her, you know, he can save her in a sense. And so when she bails on him, he goes, she's, you know, they have the monologue, there's a lot of monologue, voiceover, how she's basically, you know, a phony and all this, you know, basically the J.D. Salinger Catcher in the Rye but good stuff. So I don't know if it's just, oh, she rejected me, the hell of her.
Let's not have any trouble.
Okay, you're talking about, why won't you talk to me? Why won't you talk to me? Why don't you answer my calls when I call? You think I don't know you're here?
Let's not have any
trouble. You think I don't know?
Could you please leave?
Get your hands off.
Okay, then leave, okay?
I just want you to know that I know.
No, let's
not
have any trouble. Please, just leave. This is no place to do it.
Okay.
Take your hand off.
Okay, then just leave.
Take it off.
All right, just leave then. Come on.
I'm gonna tell you.
Look, come on.
You're in a hell, and you're gonna die in a hell like the rest.
Come on now. There's a cop across the street.
You're like the rest of them.
Look, I'm calling the cops. Officer!
What about you, Chrissy? What do you think? You're a woman perspective.
So you need to speak for all women now.
I just asked for her perspective. Okay. Was it because he got rejected because of the girl boy sex thing, or is it because she is not the person he thought she was? What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. My husband was just explaining this to me tonight because of something that I went through in the last couple of days. Men are very affected when their egos are hurt. Women are very affected when their emotions are hurt or attacked. So when a woman rejects a man, what is really hurt there is underneath is the ego. Because that is, I mean, men and women are, in all fairness, built differently. We are not the same. We are built differently because women have to give birth to things and men have to be the providers. So there is an inherent difference in that. And so when she rejects him, the reason he freaks out is because she's basically attacking him at his lowest point, which is his ego. I mean, think about it. If a woman makes you have a small penis joke to a man, he gets offended because it attacks his ego. If a woman gets offended, a woman would more likely get offended if he said, oh my God, you're so over emotional, or oh my God, there's so much drama. That's where women lose their shit. And so when I looked at her rejecting him, what I saw was his ego being destroyed. And because his ego had pretty much already been destroyed because he can't relate to people and because people seem to be putting him down, he's just kind of, you know, an odd duck. And so that was how I saw that. And yes, she's clueless too, but in all fairness, she was the typical woman of the time. She was looking to be impressed by a man. Women's lib was going on. So at that time when this movie was made. So here she is trying to be this liberated woman. I can go out and have a job and I can do this and I can do that, which was big. People forget that in the mid-1970s and the early 1970s, you know, women didn't necessarily have their rights to jobs. You know, we're still talking about the glass ceiling today. They didn't. It was a very different time in history. So you were in this weird place where women were trying to get their independence and rejecting men that they didn't really want and being vocal about it. But men were still not really comfortable with the idea that they could be rejected. So you have this whole explosion of that. And I think Scorsese in that scene
was
probably making a comment about the social status and the changing social status and positioning of women and men at that time.
Paul Schrader, not Martin Scorsese.
Paul Schrader, the writer.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, again, this film was brilliant. But that was my take on it. I saw her as kind of thinking, wow, I'm blown away by this guy. He's so charming. Maybe I can let my guard down. And then he does something that makes her uncomfortable. But you have to remember, a lot of women at that time and earlier than that, and I know this because I took feminist studies in college, so I read about all this crap, you know, ad nauseum. Send me hate mail. You know, basically, it was a different – they were trying to cope with the new social positioning of things. And they said, I can reject this guy if he takes me to a movie that I don't agree with. Whereas a woman in the 50s or the early 60s might not have. They might have rolled over and played dead and just said, well, he's just whatever. I'm just going to accept this. So I think that's another dimension we have to consider when looking at that scene, because we're forgetting that it was a different social time. And we talked about this earlier with The Witch, and we talked about it with The Revenant, I think especially, where we have to be careful when we're looking at films in the past that were socially relevant at the time. We cannot put them through the lens of today. It's different. It was different. And if we don't understand the history, we may not understand the context of the comment that was being made. So,
no, that's fair. Now, there's three major plot points that go on after the Sybil Shepherd thing, besides her ending where maybe she changes her mind and whatnot. We'll discuss that later when we get to that. But there's the Jodie Foster stuff, the wizard, even though it's a short scene, I think it's important, and then the Palantine stuff, which is after the rejection. Where do you guys want to start on some of these things? And then, of course, the interesting scene that happens right after he gets rejected by Betsy, the Sybil Shepherd character, is the cameo with Martin Scorsese in the cab. But yeah, Abe, you want to say something?
Yeah, I think we should talk about the Palantine stuff, because considering that the character Betsy is connected to this figure, you know.
All right.
Where a lot of this, you know, so basically we there's this big election coming on here with a guy called Palantine. I mean, he's no party's really this, given to us, but we could assume maybe he's Democratic or left leaning of some kind.
It's New York. It's Democratic.
Yeah.
Well, regardless, the better point is that he's this figure that's everyone's
Maybe not those times, Mike, because Ronald Reagan took New York twice. But anyway, continue.
All right. So basically, there's this big election going on here, and
Richard Nixon took New York too, as a matter of fact. But anyway, continue.
Anyways. So there's this good, nice little scene where at one point Palantine actually gets in Travis's taxi, and he's giving him a lift, and he's I just kind of, you know, this is before the rejection of Betsy rejects Travis, so he's trying to kiss up and look good, and just kind of talk to this political figure, and you know. Palatine is trying to kind of play politely, even trying to look for the guy's name on the front of the cab. And you know he's and at first it just seems kind of okay, kind of a little awkward where he's trying to discuss between citizen and politician. But then we see a moment of Travis's frustrations seeping through, where he's talking about cleaning the filth off the streets, and you've got to clean it off there, and even the little assistant next to Palantine is kind of looking at this guy like, oh man, not another one of these. You know, this is going to get ugly or something like that. And but then the reaction, the only thing that Palantine can really give Travis is like, it's, you know, it's not going to be easy. You know, the best answer you can come up with, which, you know, probably is not a great answer for sort of a big question of, you know, cleaning up these streets of crime and filth and decay that we see throughout the film. But I think this is what definitely this one interaction, or perhaps partially also due to losing out with Betsy, that kind of knocks Palantine off the pedestal along the girl of his dreams as well.
Can I ask you something, Travis?
Sure.
What is the one thing about this country that bugs you the most?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't follow political issues that closely, sir. I don't know.
Oh, well, there must be something.
Well, whatever it is, you should clean up this city here, because this city here is like an open sewer, you know? It's full of filth and scum. And sometimes I can hardly take it. Whatever becomes the president should just really clean it up. You know what I mean? Sometimes I go out and I smell it. I get headaches. It's so bad, you know? And they just like... just never go away, you know? It's like, I think that the president should just clean up this whole mess here. He should just flush it right down the fucking toilet.
Well, I think I know what you mean, Travis. But it's not gonna be easy.
Well, he was also never really a Palantine supporter. He was a Betsy supporter. And you have that wonderful exchange, like, well, whatever he's for, I'm sure it's great.
I'm sure his position on whatever on welfare is terrific. I'm sure whatever it is, I'm sure it's a good one. You know, it's and so he's not really. He just assumes he's great, and therefore he must agree with me. And so when he starts going on this rant to a guy who, based on the, they make the comment about the position on wealth, like what was it, free welfare or welfare for everyone or whatever it was. You know, he's probably, I mean, it's New York in 1976. He's probably a left-leaning candidate. And you've got this guy who's got these rather radical views on cleaning up the streets. Probably was not going to go over too well with that politician.
Yeah, it's a nice little scene there. And I also like all the other scenes where Travis shows up at the rallies. Like, for example, his little conversation with the agent there, and it's nice and awkward and very kind of weird, you know, maybe because I couldn't really figure out what his intention was at that moment there, because he was just fucking around with the agent.
I love that scene.
Yeah,
I love that scene.
It was, you know, it's just because DiCaprio was just playing it so well, just kind of.
Who?
De Niro.
De Niro, sorry. I had a fucking brain fart right there. I'm tired. But, yeah, De Niro just really knows how to bring out this really, it was a really creepy scene, but it's also kind of in a dark way because he at one point says, there's some suspicious guys over there. And then he gets the agent to come over with him to the corner of the crowd, and he's like, you know, they were just here a moment ago. I don't know where they went. And even when the agent's like, you know, if you're interested, we can send you some information with, and he's giving him all these bullshit details and fake address and everything like that.
Mr. Crinkle, hip hopper lane.
Yeah, like the rabbit, hip and hop.
Pity hop.
My name is Henry Crinkle, K-R-I-N-K-L-E. 154 Hopper Avenue.
Hopper.
Yeah. You know, like a rabbit hip hop. Fairlawn, New Jersey.
Is there a zip code in that, Henry?
Yeah, 610452. Okay.
That's six digits.
61045.
Okay.
I was thinking of my telephone number.
Well, I've got it all. Henry, we'll get all the stuff right out to you.
Thanks a lot. Hey, great. Thanks a lot. Help. Jesus. Be careful today.
Right, will do.
You have to be careful around a place like this. Bye.
Well, even that, the whole thing was like a game of a mind game, because I don't think for a moment that the the Secret Service guy thought he was in his right mind.
Also, Mike, I don't know if Travis Bickle knew he was really tricking the guy. He may have like was just being a dink. In other words, Travis Bickle was giving him the fake stuff, and he knew that it wasn't going to go through anyway. He knew. So, I don't know. I mean, it's a good question.
Well, and there's the whole thing of where this ends up with him showing up at the speech. Because I don't really think, I mean, correct me if I'm totally missing something here, but Travis Bickle really didn't have anything against Palpatine.
Right.
But he just wanted to, that would be a way of showing that he was better than him. To show off for Betsy, right?
Yeah.
Ooh. And we get back to the ego issue again that I had mentioned before. You know, it's almost like he had to prove that he was a man. And
if I could interject just one second, it's prove that he's the one that's going to save the world, not Palpatine.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and yet we already see, you know, there's a lot of, we haven't even touched on all of the visual metaphor and all of the metaphor in the script in this film. But I have tons of notes on that. But you know, he's already a fatalist. I mean, in his opening voiceover when he's driving the cab, you know, the opening scene we see is these clouds of smoke and the warlike music. So that sort of suggests that he's been through a trauma. But then he goes into this whole speech about thank God for the rain.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning, sometimes even 8 in the morning, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in 350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. Skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets.
And then right after that, he writes that he's so happy, he's working all these hours, and that's a metaphor for cleansing his soul, which he also mentions, and that work keeps him focused. And that someday the real rain, and this is what foreshadows this whole thing with Palantine at the end, he says, or he writes, someday in the voiceover, someday the real rain will wash all the scum off the streets. And that's a metaphor for death. It's a metaphor for someday this will all be over. But it's also
vengeance.
Foreshadows
vengeance.
His vengeance. Exactly. Mm. And he says, all the animals come out at night. And your worst demons hit you in the dark. And that's a direct, you know, that's basically what he's suggesting. Your worst demons hit you in the dark. And that's a metaphor and a foreshadowing for what he does with Palpatine, because his worst demons hit him in the dark. That dark of this girl rejecting him, and now he has to go out and prove that he's the bigger man. Now he's in a dark place. He is reacting fully on instinct. And it's amazing that in the first minute and a half of that film, or 2 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever that opening thing is, we basically see what this entire movie is about. And we already know that he's going to go do something awful, that it is going to escalate to that point just from what he says.
Yep. Going back to the actual scene that Abe was talking about where he gives the fake address and all that, the Secret Service guy, they want to try to take a photo of him because they really think this guy is dangerous. Which, to be honest, is probably not true in real life, because the Secret Service are incompetent assholes. But in fiction land, they actually know what they're doing. But
if they knew what they were doing, they would have taken you in long ago.
You know what, Mike? They're coming for all of us, believe me. The government is bad. Anyway, to be back to reality and not being a wise ass. The problem is that Palantine's motorcade comes up at that moment when they're going to try to get a picture of him, and they're unable to get it. And so Travis disappears into the crowd. And then he goes and buys guns. One of the best scenes in the film, in my opinion. Anybody want to talk about the gun scene, when he buys the guns?
Well, I would.
A lot of guns.
I would like to mention this one thing before Eric gets started. I watched a lot of the special features, and I watched, like, there's a 2-hour like documentary on there, and Scorsese is talking. Yeah. And what's interesting is they mention the thing about the mohawk where he shaves his hair. And I don't remember it exactly, so forgive me, but it was something like in Vietnam, that was what the undercover killers wore or something. Did anybody who watched remember that?
Yes. Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
Okay, maybe you can elaborate on that and make it clear to listeners.
I don't
remember it, but it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I unfortunately am right there with you, Chrissy. I don't remember it fully, but it's something to do with the people that that were more violent or really hit the reels, were really into it. The Nam, you know, in the jungle, they shave their heads. But I unfortunately don't know as much either. I forget as well, Chrissy, the full details.
Okay, I feel a little better now because I was feeling really guilty that I didn't write it down. But and that apparently was very specific, and they did that on purpose with the filming of this because they were trying to show his return to his primal state. And that's definitely a but that's a quote from, I didn't make that up myself. I got that from the special feature on the film where Scorsese said, yeah, we did that on purpose. We were trying to show his return to his primal state. That was very warlike, and it's where he talks about the opening with the smoke, and all that. And he said, you know, we were trying to show this breakdown of this individual and the fact that he goes and buys all these guns because, you know, like you mentioned earlier, he was very comfortable. And I think Mike said, you know, he shows a proficiency with that. It's a return to that base state. So Eric, I'm sorry. I totally interrupted you. You were going to talk about all the guns. So go ahead.
That's all I had to say is that there was a lot of them.
All right, what about you, Abe? You were going to say something about
it. Yeah, what's really cool about this weapon scene is that he selects a certain amount of weapons, and it's really becomes a really unique moment of Chekhov's gun, that trope, because each of those weapons he does use the finale. They each serve a purpose to some extent, and I thought it was really cool. But also with the dealer was explaining to him about certain weapons and how some were better than the others, like the 38 over the 44. Because at first you think the 44 is going to be the big weapon at the end, but it's averted at the during the finale when it turns out to be the stub nose that really does the most use for him. So I thought that was really clever how that all came together, that every weapon gets used. So it wasn't all just all flared for just the extra bang,
And
literally bang for his buck.
I just want to point out set that up earlier in the film when they talk about the one cabbie who got attacked.
Yeah.
And one of his coworkers says, "Hey man, you know, you should go out there armed. I can hook you up." Right? I know a guy. So this is speaking of Chekhov's gun, so they mention it right there in the first act. And it turns into Chekhov's arsenal.
Yeah, I was going to say, I imagine his buddy didn't think he was going to buy all the guns.
Yeah, well, it was a good deal. I thought he would have thrown the holster in for free. That would have been nice.
He should have.
There was curiosity about that, too, is that basically it's all underground stuff. So it's guns that are being sold underground, not legally. And then the other thing that was interesting, too, is that Abe not necessarily correct, but add to one thing Abe said. Actually, one of the guns was used to shoot a robber at a convenience store. So that gun doesn't show up in the finale because what happens is there's a Puerto Rican guy has a shop. Travis goes in there all the time because the guy says, "Hey, Travis, how you doing? You know, que pasa? You know, whatever." And then this black guy comes in and starts robbing the store. And so Travis takes out his gun and kills him. Or not kills him, but wounds him pretty bad. And the Puerto Rican guy takes the gun from Travis, says, "Don't worry about it. I'll take care of all this." Travis sneaks out, and as he's sneaking out, the Puerto Rican guy is taking a baseball bat or a tire iron and starts clubbing the black guy to death. And so it's a gruesome scene. But it also shows that Travis is capable, even if it was in self-defense, to shoot somebody. So it's almost like, I don't know if it's a foreshadowing, but it's at least a journey.
I was assuming he was able to do that if he was in the Marines.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah,
he could have been cleaning toilets.
He was in the Marines.
Right. So did anybody have anything else to say about the gun sale?
Well, I just like the offer of the Cadillac at the end.
Yeah, yeah. I got the pink slip for $2,000 for the Cadillac. Do you want some? I got uppers. I got downers. I got what's the shit that they sell in Breaking Bad?
Amphetamines. I got crystal meth. You want some crystal? I got crystal meth. Yeah. And then just out of nowhere, how about a Cadillac? You know,
I got the pinks, like $2,000. Yeah.
How about dope? Grass, ash, coke, mescaline, downers, nebutal, toluol, chloral hydrates. How about uppers, amphetamines?
No, I'm not interested in that stuff.
Crystal meth. I can get you crystal meth. Nitrous oxide. How about that? How about a Cadillac? I get you a brand new Cadillac with the pink slip for $2,000.
What was really interesting to me in that scene was they're in this apartment and the furniture in it is clearly early 1960s falling apart, which I just thought was kind of fun.
Like, yeah, I don't even know if it was
behind them with like the knobs missing and shit, and I was like, oh my god, the lights they went to.
I don't even think it was an apartment. It could have been an apartment, but I think it was one of those places where that pimps let their prostitutes bring people and also let the gun, you know, it's like the $10 for 1 hour type of rooms.
How would you know about those places, Phil?
Because I've seen movies. Okay. All right. Hey, I saw this film when I was 10 years old.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, I see. Never and mind. This is one of the things I do like is that this is there's such a difference between a 1976 movie shot in 1976 versus say a 2016 movie that's set in 1976.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that, definitely.
And that you are just, you know, and it's always been true no matter what period you're in, right? Versus, you know, trying to do a 50s film as opposed to a film that was actually filmed in the 50s. Because you will get things. You would never put 60s furniture in a 70s film.
Right.
You would put 70s furniture in a 70s film.
Yep.
Even though if you really were in the 70s, a lot of shit was left over from the 60s and the 50s and the 40s.
Yep.
You know, you would just – and everybody would be wearing 70s clothes as opposed to, you know, just people wearing whatever clothes came off the rack, some of which stand out as being very 70s and others of which would just – I mean, just fit just as well today.
Oh, believe me, Mike, I was wearing 1965 hand-me-downs when I was 5 years old in 1975, and I was picked on for it because my mother says, oh, these are good, but she's not the one going to school.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. So yes.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah, my mom could never understand why the jeans had to be Levi's.
Right, exactly, Eric. It's horrible. They tortured us, our parents.
Yeah. They did.
Those are excellent points and observations, both by you, Chrissy, to notice that in the first place, and both by you, Mike, to notice that a true period piece is made in that period. Get that. I mean, it was probably easier back then, too, anyway, because, you just pull out a friggin' camera, and you there you go. You got the prostitutes walking down the streets and the porno shops and stuff. Well, nowadays, you know, they have to make sets for that because it's not there anymore. So it's a little interesting. Well, yeah, Eric. What about the?
I just wanted to talk about the Jodie Foster character.
All right. Before you do that, I wanted to ask you, Eric, specifically. Do you think the moment he shaved his head was when was the point where he was gone? Coming back.
It was. Yeah, yeah. I think he decided what he was going to do at that point.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So let's talk the Jodie Foster thing. Because that's the big storyline for the second half of the film.
Well, yeah, and again, like with the Sybil Shepherd character, correct me if I'm wrong, but the only reason that he's involved in her life whatsoever is by happenstance that she happened to walk in front of his car, right?
That's right.
And he's mentally unstable.
Yeah. So she crosses the street in front of him, and he goes all stalker on her, finds out she's a prostitute. And pays money to spend time with her, but then doesn't want to do what people normally do with prostitutes and wants to talk her out of being a prostitute.
Now, a couple of things of importance to add to that, Eric. One, the first time he meets her, she runs into the cab and she says, take me out of here. Just start driving. And before he can drive, Harvey Keitel's character, who plays the pimp, pulls her out, throws him $100 bill or something like that, and says, you don't see anything here, cabbie, no problems. And he takes Jodie Foster away. And Travis, and that $100 bill, crumbled $100 bill is a symbol the entire film, because at the end, he gives it back to the quote unquote bad guys or mm-hmm. the pimp. So that's an important right. fact. And then.
Well, and that was the right thing to do. To sure. give it back.
Well, I don't know about that.
What if he didn't ignore everything that he saw.
Maybe it was to symbolize, you know, giving back dirty money.
Oh, I'm sure that's, yeah. I mean, he considered the pimp, Harvey Keitel's character, and all his crew as the filth that has to be cleaned up on the streets. And he ain't going to take dirty money from those people, especially someone that he wants to save, because he obviously says, okay, she's a troubled person. She wants to get away from this guy. So later in the movie, he just randomly drives into her again because she like is gone from the film. And the only reason, you know, this is Manhattan, you know, 10 million people in the whole city or whatever it is, 15 million, never mind the tourist. He's not going to probably see her again. And then he does. And that's when he decides to, spend time with her, I guess.
But the whole thing about him sort of, quote, saving her, you know, there's a moment earlier in the film where he talks about, you know, July. They're in the month of July or something about July, and it brings an anniversary, I guess. Does anybody remember that letter?
Yeah.
He sends a letter to his parents, and he lies about being on a government mission.
Yep.
Where he says, I know it's like your birthday and an anniversary, and I'm just going to try to hit it all here with one card.
Right, so, and I missed Father's Day or whatever it was. And that to me was sort of interesting because later on, you know, this character, Travis, even though we identify with him and his frustration or whatever, it was really brilliant writing here by Schrader because we needed to have a redemptive moment for him. And his treatment of Jodie Foster character almost becomes a redemptive moment because in the end, he's trying to, quote, save her in his own twisted way. And that was his moment of redemption for me. That was when he truly became a man, or he became a stand-up guy who was trying to do the right thing. Did have that one moment. So,
but was he really doing it because he believed in it, or was it some sort of, like you said earlier, Chrissy, an ego?
You know, I think it could have gone both ways. I think that ego is one thing, but when you truly get to the raw emotion of something, there is a lot of water symbolism in this film. We have the rain on the windshield in the beginning, distorting, you know, the lights that he sees. We have the whole eye motif going on, which is about perception. You know, so I think that he really did genuinely want to protect her at that point because of all that water imagery. And it kind of says, you know, there was a real person in there. I think that his relationship with Sybil was all about his ego. I think his relationship with Jodie was more about his emotion, because we do see that letter to his parents, you know, before he meets Jodie Foster, you know, officially, or maybe it was right around that time, but I think it was directly before, where he sort of becomes more fully dimensional as a human. And maybe less, you know, maybe less dependent on his ego. But then he reverts at the end. And then you have this very complicated marriage of his emotions and his ego together, which is always where you get a really complex character, which is why this script should be so appreciated.
And you have, by the way, Mike gave me the script for Christmas last year. Appreciate it. But the thing is, Chrissy, the one thing between the Sybil Shepherd and the Jodie Foster thing is that is the same, whether it's ego or emotion, is he wants to save somebody.
Well, yeah, and Jodie Foster, perhaps in some way, although I don't think this was actually alluded to in the film, even in terms of symbolism, he's trying to save himself. And so perhaps saving her is the next best thing.
Well,
or the closest he can get toward comfort or something, or to think he's on the right track.
Because
desperate people who are really lost if they realize it, and I almost think this character did know that he was screwed up. He just couldn't figure anything out.
Well, we'll talk about the wizard scene because that kind of sums it up. But Eric, you were going to say something?
Yes, the wizard scene addresses that. Go ahead, Eric.
I was going to say that there's also the fact that he's a Vietnam vet, and that war was not a victory for the side that he was on. And maybe he wanted a victory, and that's part of the reason why he did it too.
Oh, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, do any of you guys – we were all kids, I think, and I don't think Abe was even born.
No, I wasn't.
But do any of you guys remember your parents telling you stories about watching the Vietnam War footage on TV and how violent that was? Because I remember my dad telling me about that. And,
my parents, we never – I didn't even know the Vietnam War existed until I was like – when I saw this film, to be honest, because I didn't know much about it, because even though 75 was when the fall of Saigon happened,
right.
I, for some reason, it wasn't on my radar, even though I was 5 years old, which was odd because,
five-year-olds usually do watch the nightly news with Dan Rath.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the first political thing of interest that I remember was Gerald Ford against Jimmy Carter, and that was in 1976. So it was after Nam. And my first major event after Nam, I mean, after the Gerald Ford Carter thing, was the Iranian Revolution. So Nam was literally right before I started paying attention to politics. So I was 6 years old when I started, and Nam ended officially for South Vietnam, anyway, if not the U.S., in 1975.
Yeah, and I might have been more exposed to that than most kids, even at a really young age, just because my dad was in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I remember him telling me I was either going to go to Nam or I was going to end up, you know, even though it was in the 60s, that shit was already going on. And it was also the tail end of Korea. And I remember him sitting me down and telling me all of this crap when I was like 6 or 7 years old and I could barely comprehend what the hell was going on. But it was always sort of like I was always sort of aware of it. And I do remember my dad in later years being very angry about the way the Vietnam vets were treated when they came home, which is why he hated hippies until the day he died. You know, he said, yeah, I hate hippies. They're all losers. You don't swear at people who just went and did that, whether or not it was their choice. You don't swear at, you know, servicemen going over there and doing that. And so I think in my house it was probably more of a pivotal issue than it was in many households. And even though I was very young, I was also a lot more mature for my age, sadly. So I was kind of paying attention to things. And interestingly enough, my father never wanted me to see Taxi Driver, which is probably the reason that I got to see it here with Charles, because I was feeling all rebellious and shit. And I was like, hey, my dad never wanted me to see this. What the hell is going on with this movie that he doesn't want me to see it? And then I clearly started to understand some of the things. Even though he wasn't in Nam, he had friends who were. And I think that probably is what skewed my viewing of this the first time. And then this last time, this is only the second time that I saw it. I was really a lot more informed because I've read a lot. So I think if you don't know about Vietnam and you want to see this film, you need to read a little bit about it first, because I think it will really inform and enhance your viewing experience.
Yeah, I kind of my uncles and my father were all in the military, and my father was in the missile crisis, was serving in the Navy during the missile crisis, and also growing up in a Catholic family in the 1970s, you kind of couldn't miss the hosannas to the Kennedys. But
damn straight, yep, yes.
So.
Yeah, so I mean, I had some awareness of it, and I just, you know, didn't process a lot of it because I was young, and you don't understand that. I just kind of knew that, you know, I knew the sequence of wars. It was World War One, World War Two, Korea, Vietnam, and I was fully expecting, you know, and at that point we were, you know, in the middle of the Cold War. I figured my war is going to be about 30 seconds long.
I was fighting Cubans and Russians.
But, and that's why when you got to, when I was in college in 1990 and we got to the first Gulf War, you had a, there were friends of mine who were kind of losing their shit because they were fully expecting this to be a 10-year Vietnam thing and get, go, they're going to bring back the draft. And the reality, my generation's war, which ended up being the first Gulf War, lasted for about 90 minutes and it was over and it was pretty easy. And, you know, by the time you got to 9/11, you know, I was 31, kind of out of that prime age for entering into service. I could have, and I know people who did, but, you know, that sort of window closed. So it was this weird skip generation because the Cold War stayed cold, and the one thing that could have been a big blow-up really fizzled.
That's right, but, because of great people like Boris Yeltsin.
Well, we won't get into the reasons why, but yeah, there were a lot of people that were responsible for it. And there's history books for that.
Vytautas Landsbergis of Lithuania. God bless.
But yeah, but I did grow up in a fairly conservative and obviously because they all served in the military, fairly pro-military household. And so yeah, the same thing, the stories of what, you know, the Vietnam vets had to go through. I didn't necessarily get a great understanding of what went on in Vietnam until I was much older. You know, but yeah, I was, you know, the whole looking down on the vets as they returned because whatever the you know, it was the old, we would have won if it wasn't for the politicians tying our hands behind our backs. You know, that whole thing. And always heard that. And it wasn't right to be spitting on the vets and all that. And it was, you know, you got instilled their respect. Yeah. And you still see it now because now no matter how anti-war someone is, for the most part, they still say, but we love our vets. They always make sure to add that in there. Because they don't want to be lumped in with, you know, the people who did this, that did that
assholes.
Back then. Yeah.
Assholes. Yep. The Polish Spring, all the good stuff.
Good water.
It's just interesting because I think part of the reason Taxi Driver became the well-revered film that it was. I think going back to what Mike said, growing up in a conservative military household, I get all that. It really tried to bring attention to the individual who suffered that through that as opposed to the group. And maybe people didn't see that at the time because, you know, sometimes hindsight is 20/20. So maybe they didn't see that at the time. But it just, I think this film is so awesome because, like you said, it encapsulates a whole world. It doesn't just encapsulate New York in the 70s. Well, it encapsulates people being destroyed by war and people, I mean, there's just so much going on in this.
Well, I think the film works a lot too, and the Travis Bickle character and all these other things is because the film's point wasn't to be a political statement, even though politics is important. Like Abe said, we don't really know, is it Republican or Democrat, Palantine? We have no idea.
No, exactly. Yeah. We don't know. Yep.
Yeah, and so it's all we know is that he's a scumbag because he's one of the two parties. But besides that point, the thing is that the film was really more to do with the character study of Travis and the peripheral characters that happen to be around him. And that, I think that's why, unlike other films with a Vietnam vet, whether they're coming home or in Vietnam, are very political. And so this film doesn't fall into any of that, subgenre of Vietnam film. It just happens to be 1976 and the character being the age he was, even though De Niro was 31 at the time, he was playing a 26-year-old, he was coming back from Nam. And that's it.
Well, and also, honestly, I was very struck this time by how relevant this film still is today. We are struggling now with you know, all of these public shootings and these mass shootings and, you know, people are arguing for gun control. And then there's the other part that's arguing for mental health issues. And if you strip all of the timing away from this, like being set in the 70s and the Vietnam War, we are really subjected to a character study of a person who has been affected by something that is eventually going to go postal, which was not a phrase that came in until the 80s or 90s, right?
A timeless person.
It's a timeless person. And I think that's why this film is still relevant today. And I think that's why everyone, especially like the millennials who didn't go through Vietnam and didn't, you know, or whatever, all of us, everybody should
see this. The Cold War, all that stuff.
The Cold War, all that stuff, because it goes back to the whole Poe thing. A person can be driven mad by extreme circumstance. And so Edgar Allan Poe was actually writing about this same shit in the 1880s. It's just people forget that. It's just the different ways that we examine it now. Well, and now there's so much social media and everybody can make a freaking derogatory comment whenever they feel like doing it. And nobody's thinking about it. They're just shooting things out of their ass without actually thinking about what's involved.
Because they're assholes, like Eric would say.
Mike, you're assholes. Yes.
Well, I'm saying, well, this is what makes – I mean, there's been a lot of movies made about Vietnam. And some of them are classics. Some of them are hokey, whatever you think about them. You know, whether you're talking about, Rambo or First Blood or, you know, Apocalypse Now, Platoon,
Coming
Born
Home
on the 4th of July. All of these, almost all of these, you would need to be in a deep, deep, deep coma to not get the political, quote-unquote, undertones in those films, right? They all have their point of view. And they're all really, really blunt and obvious in dealing with it. And this is something that's speaking to one of the most pretentious artistic phrases is the human condition. But that is what it's dealing with. It's the humanity of Travis Bickle. What and when he served is kind of irrelevant to the time. You could do something like this. It would be work quite so well in New York, but you could set it in, Detroit or Chicago right now, and you could kind of get away with the same basic storyline.
Even get away with the same basic storyline in a rural town.
Yeah.
At this point, I mean, today, it's relevant to today. You know, honestly, we have shootings and things going on in rural towns right now.
Mental illness, people pissed about being stuck. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. It's true, but Phil's right. You know, there's a lot of crazy right now in the world. There always has
been. Or not necessarily crazy, but liberated. Freedom. Rage.
Oh, my God.
No, crazy.
Oh, Lord. Let's not go there. Crazy.
I'm going to defend those people. I'm going to defend them.
That's because you are crazy.
We must burn down the machine.
Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, back to the movie.
Anyways.
So let's talk about the finale and the very, very ending, Chrissy? The
epilogue? The coda?
Yeah, coda. That's the word I'm looking for. Excellent. Yes, so let's talk about the ending and the coda. Let's do that.
Well, the desaturated red was really interesting. They were forced to do it, and unfortunately, on the special or whatever, in the special features, one of the documentaries we watched talked about how they actually did find the original where it was not desaturated red, and they had wanted to restore it for the new version that came out for the 40th anniversary, but it had so degraded that they couldn't do it. I was really glad because I think the desaturated red works. It would have been too stupid. It would have been like everything I watch in 2016. Let's put, like food coloring in the guy's ass and like watch him bleed out his ass, which just really would have degraded it.
But that was an odd example, but okay.
Yeah,
okay,
what movie? I don't remember. If we've watched the Mod films, I don't remember that one.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I've watched so much bad gore with you guys, it just all blurs together. Maybe I'm talking about 31.
Jesus. All right.
If you've seen some 70s films, they still hadn't gotten blood right. I mean, the worst example probably is Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where it's this pinkish orange, depending on the scene. It's, you know, very fake looking, Hammer horror film looking blood.
All you have to do is watch the movie Carrie, which came out a few years before, and say, oh, you just use pig's blood.
Actually, that was the same year, wasn't it? 76 or was it 77?
That was 74, I thought, Carrie, wasn't it? Oh, maybe you're right. Maybe it's 76. Oh, 76, yeah, same year. Yeah, well, I meant for Dawn of the Dead. That was 78.
Yeah. Yeah. What I really liked about this finale was that it didn't use any of those kind of action techniques that you would normally see in a lot of gunfight scenes. You know, it wasn't all choreography. It was very raw and very, almost very realistic.
I kill ya!
It was just how human it felt. No one felt like an action hero at this moment. Everyone was fucking making mistakes. Everyone was getting hurt. And it was a short scene too. Like I think as any gun battle would last only like less than a minute or so. It was a very short scene, but it was very impactful. And
you know,
it was brutal as well.
Abe, you know no one named Iris? Do you know no one named Iris? I don't know no one named Iris.
Hey, sport, how you doing?
Okay, my man. Where do I know you from, man?
I don't know. How's everything in the pimp business, huh?
Do I know you?
No. Do I know you?
Get out of here. Come on, get lost, huh?
Do I know you? How's Iris? You know Iris.
No, you know I don't Iris. Know nobody named Iris. Iris, come on, get out of here, man.
You don't know anybody named Iris?
I don't know nobody named Iris.
No?
Hey, get back to your fucking tribe before you get hurt, huh, man? Do me a favor. I don't want no trouble, huh? Okay?
You got a gun?
Fuck out of here, man. Get out of here. Suck on this.
And that was the beginning of the whole scene. That was the
best. Yeah. I just love that moment he just shoots him and he just kind of just trots off.
Yeah, he goes, suck on this, and he shoots
him. Boom. And I was actually really surprised, like, holy shit, the fucker's still alive when he pops up again. I just love how he just falls a complete out of chaos because you expect this giant, you know, expect from other gun fights in other movies, this giant shootout with bullet holes everywhere. But this is just, it was just
chaos.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the symbol. If we really look at that chaos, that's what the whole film was trying to say, that the world is chaos.
But it was such a good, well shot scene. But I also love how it was just kind of closes with him trying to end his own life, but he has no fucking bullets left. And he just sits down on the couch and it's really creepy because he just, he tries to, I guess, try to get the cops to shoot him by making a point of his finger at them like he has a gun.
Exactly.
And yeah. They won't shoot him, so he just puts it to his head. He's like,
it was awesome.
When
I was a 10-year-old boy watching that, I was like, yes, this is great.
You know, for a minute,
no, this explains some things.
So much.
I was going to
say, Phil, very much.
I clearly understand your so fucked upness now.
Sorry, I was just obviously trying to be funny. But continue, Abe, I'm sorry.
For a minute, I thought the movie was actually just going to end at that scene, just stop right there first. I didn't expect the epilogue, but, you know.
All right. Anybody else want to talk about the pimp shootout scene before we get into the coda? Basically, it was very intense. I love how Abe explained it. It was just total anarchy, chaos. It was unscripted. I mean, it just was like how it probably would really go down rather than, you know, these gunfights that we see in Hollywood Westerns or Hollywood shiny films like Rambo. It was just so gritty. I mean, this was true, 1976. This scene, perfect for that era. I mean, that's cinema at that era. That's how it was. It was almost like B-movie madness.
Well, and a comment before we get into the coda. I just wrote down in my notes the word no in giant capital letters. I honestly think that it should have ended with that lovely overhead shot,
right.
Which was that's where it should have ended. No, there should have been no coda.
No.
Yeah, no. No happy coda. That was bullshit. Yeah,
No. You have to have the ended. You have to have the coda because it shows that he's.
No, it doesn't. No, you don't. No, right, because right, what right, the, right. That for me that erased the whole point of the fucking film.
Right.
Let's show a happy ending. You know what that looked like to me? Oh, they showed it with the original ending.
Chrissy, you watched the document.
And the assholes went, oh, wait, there's no happy ending. What the
fuck? No, that's absolutely not. This was in the screenplay from the beginning. Didn't you watch Paul Schrader? Paul Schrader said the point of the whole coda was to show that he's going to do it again.
Okay, no, well, I didn't get it that out of it. I did not get that out of it, so I'm sorry.
It was awesome how Schrader said it in the documentary. He goes, basically, it's like a clock. It's a clock. You start at the 60 seconds and you just go around. And then when you hit the 60 seconds again, which is the end of the film, it begins all over again.
Yeah, but I watched the documentary again before I watched the film the second time. And so I remembered that and I wrote it down and I was like, this coda doesn't work. And it didn't work for me the first time.
And the other thing that was awesome about the coda.
It's not clear. It's not clear.
Well, the other thing that was awesome about the coda was Betsy's back in his cab, basically willing to take him out of the insanity. I mean, obviously he's still being insane anyway, but in her eyes and in his eyes, he could get out of it because she wants to go with him again. And he turns it down to become still the crazy vigilante.
Yeah, but that it was not clear. If you're going to do a coda like that on a film like this, it's like when you're writing a short story and you want to have your readers go, oh, it's clearly implied he's going to do this again. That was not clearly implied enough.
That's your opinion. I think I saw it perfectly.
She is speaking her opinion. Yes, that's her point.
Yes, right. Exactly.
That's fair. I did like one other aspect too. Is when he snaps because he's looking in the mirror and they have that reverse sound effect that makes him like freak for a second because it's showing that he's already beginning to unwind and he has to turn the rear view mirror to look back to see what's there and there's nothing there. I thought that was cool. But anyway, that's just my opinion too. Right. It's just opinions. That's all this is. Opinions. What's your guy?
Yeah, it's his opinions, but you know, I'm just saying if it's in the writing of it. And Eric, is that you laughing?
Yeah, I was just saying she's just saying that her opinion's correct.
That's right. And I was thinking that too, and I was my eyes were rolling. If we had visuals, I would say, Eric, put up the eye rolling picture, please. Now Mike and Abe, your opinion of the coda or any other further things about the pimp fight, which is awesome for a 10-year-old to watch. It was great.
Well, I mean, I've already seen
Phil, you are so fucked up. That's all I have to say.
I'm just saying it.
Jesus, I know.
Good Lord. I mean, I've already seen what I wanted to say about the gunfight, but, you know, I honestly felt that the movie could have been very strong with just ending after the gunfight with that overhead shot, because that was a pretty awesome shot. At first, I thought that was how the film was going to close and press the role from that point. And, I mean, I'm kind of mixed on the little extra bit at the end. I didn't hate it, but I didn't like it as much as how the film could have closed out. But it makes
it look like it's a Jacob's Ladder ending, too, because is he dead and this is in his mind as he's dying?
No.
Ooh.
No, they've come out and said, no, that's not what happened.
I know, but it was a good theory.
What did happen, but I would have been
It was
better.
A great theory, though. It was a great theory, I thought. But anyway, continue, Ed.
But, you know, overall, I mean, either way, I was overall happy with the film. I mean, I expected it to end one way and got something different, but I'm not really too bothered by it. But that's just me.
What about you, Mike? Your opinion of the coda and any aspect of the pimp fight, which was awesome for a 10-year-old to watch.
Well, you know, this is one of those films that it's had its influence. And so by the time I saw that and God, almost 25 years, 26 years ago. Wow, that's – I'm old. I'm so old.
I was 10.
It's, yeah.
36 years ago.
Well, but it's just a thought in my head that at the time that I saw the film, I was thinking it was an old film and it had been 14 years old and now we're on its 40th anniversary.
And you had already seen Freddy's and all that shit. Well, this
Well, but I'm saying, and I'm saying, but now, I mean, just, you know, it's almost been double the time since it's been released from compared to that first film, you know, and just how much time is first my first viewing of it. It's even older, and therefore I'm even older. But yeah, obviously things – you've had other things, other violent films have borrowed, shall we say, liberally from this film. And I've seen certainly far more graphic stuff. So it loses some of the impact, but it's still a well-done scene, an impressive scene, and that again, that wonderful overhead shot. And I can see the merits for ending it there. And I was thinking that should be kind of the ending. The fact that this is such a well-crafted film and that if Scorsese and Schrader didn't see that that should be the ending, then maybe there's more to it, that coda that I'm not quite picking up on. I do think, you know, having lived through the Bernie Goetz experience in 1984 or whenever that was.
Right, yeah.
There would have been a very different ending to this film, I think, if it had been made 8 years later, because we saw, you know, he became like an instant celebrity nationwide.
Yep. Sure.
And there was no great technological leap that happened between 76 and 84, you know, like the internet or something where you could say that wouldn't have happened. Clearly someone who goes in, kills a pimp, to try to rescue a 12-year-old girl, who had been sold into, who was living in prostitution, obviously that he would have been arrested. He would have been all over the media. He would have been a national celebrity. You would have had Travis Bickle for president shirts, which of course you did end up getting in real life.
And he would have gone to jail.
And probably would have gone to jail. So it was an interesting,
first degree murder, life, multiple times. Even if he was killing scumbags.
Hinckley got locked up in a mental institution.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, but those can actually be harder to get out of sometimes than the than the prison.
36 years it took him, but he got out.
So anyway, and the one thing I just had to think was, you know, they got the letter from Jodie Foster's parents.
Yeah, we didn't talk about it.
She's a 12-year-old girl, and she's back home and she's going back to school, and I'm just wondering, you know, what her little essay of how I spent my summer vacation is going to be written.
I was going to say, how do you go back to being a normal kid after a prostitute in New York
What I did on my summer vacation? My summer vacation, I did oral, I did anal, whatever they wanted.
That's what Harvey Keitel said.
Exactly.
You could do anything you want to her.
Exactly. And that's what I had in the back of my head. Well, I was like thinking of that because it was bad enough that it's a 12-year-old. But then when he describes her in those terms, that was just that took creepy to creepier.
Right.
I mean,
that scene where they're dancing just made me feel unclean.
So yeah, it's exactly how does she go back? How do you put him back on the farm after they've been to the big city? I don't know.
Right.
Well, a couple other interesting things about that letter was you could tell that they were working class and folk and not that wealthy, because they go, we don't have enough money to come and visit you again when we tried to you and we picked up our daughter. You were still in your coma, et cetera, et cetera. But they still sent them the letter, you know, which is all you really can do, you know.
So, yeah, like I said, I have mixed feelings about it, and
it was the greatest ever. Sorry.
but I can kind of understand. Yeah, it's going to happen again, but you know, that does, I don't know if that feels to me like they're forcing the ending as opposed to having the actual ending that really would have happened.
Well,
actually, if him even ending with the letter and him being in the coma, you know, I probably would have felt a little better about.
Another reason why I think the coda is good is because, and Schrader and even Scorsese both say it in the documentary, is that it allows us to see that he actually is a sociopath. He's not just mentally gone or a little schizo. He's a sociopath. He has no feelings.
I don't think that's true. I don't know that that's true.
I was going to say, I don't think that's true.
Well, even sociopaths have feelings. They have rage and all that shit. But his personality is everything is an object, and the emotions are based on what makes him happy or angry or sad. Not
well. Then what was the whole fucking deal with him and Cybill Shepherd?
He was trying to save him. It made him happy because he's a sociopath.
I think you just like saying that word.
Take a drink.
I'm going with Schrader and Scorsese. They made the film. And I can see the point, because a sociopath has plenty of emotions. It's just that it's all focused on them. Everybody around them, including Jodie Foster's character and Cybill Shepherd's character, are just objects to play with or kill or save.
All right.
That's right. But on another note, we forgot to talk about the wizard. This is important because he knows he's there's something wrong with him, and he goes to see the wizard. So the wizard, who's the wizard? Well, who wants to say who the wizard
Peter,
is?
Peter Boyle's the wizard. I was freaked out watching this now because the first time I saw this movie, I didn't know who Peter Boyle was. And like looking at that guy and trying to reconcile that with. From The Creature and Young Frankenstein and The Dad and Everybody Loves Raymond. I'm just like, wow, my brain, ow, it hurts.
Well, it's like the scummy character he played in Monsters Ball, you know? I mean, that's the thing about Peter Boyle. See, I saw him, this is the first time I ever saw him. So to me, he was the gritty guy. So I never saw him in the sitcoms or all that. So I can see how someone like you, Eric, who didn't saw him as a sitcom person first,
right,
would look at this and go, "Oh, that's kind of gross or weird."
He's really good in the sitcoms too.
It's like that guy in RoboCop, the lead bad guy in RoboCop.
Clarence Boddicker,
I never saw him.
Fred Foreman.
The first time I ever saw him was in that. So anytime I would see him, I always think of him as the gritty bad guy, and so when I found out that he was a good dad in some comedy show, I was like, that's weird. But anyway, I'm sorry to digress, but Eric, you continue about Peter Boyle and the wizard.
You have more to say about it than I do. I just had trouble reconciling him as being that same actor.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, basically what it is that Peter Boyle is a cabbie as well, and all these cabbies hang out at this diner in Manhattan somewhere, and one day Bickle says, I need to talk to you. And he goes, I don't talk to you much. I don't talk to anybody much, but I have to tell you stuff. And he starts talking about how he's saying, I have bad things in my head. I feel like doing some bad things. I'm sick and tired of, you know, this city's filth and all this crap. I want to do something. I don't know what to do. And typical, you know, the wizard is, okay, he may be the quote unquote leader of these misfits, but he's still he's not a psychologist or psychiatrist. So all he says is, you know, go off and get laid, you know, have fun, take a vacation, you know, whatever. And Bickle insults him without knowing it by saying, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. And he goes, what do you want me to tell you? I'm a cabbie, you know, but, you know, just take it easy.
I figure you've been around a lot, so you could shoot. That's why they call me the wizard. It's just that I got a...
Things got you down?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the best of.
Yeah, it got me real down, real down. Just want to go out and, you know, like really, really, really do something.
Taxi life, you mean?
Yeah, well, nah, it's, I don't know. I just want to go out. I really want to. I got some bad ideas in my head. I just.
Oh, look at it this way. You know, a man takes a job, you know? And that job, I mean, like that, you know, that becomes what he is. You know, like, you do a thing and that's what you want. I mean, like, I've been a cabbie for 17 years, you know? 10 years at night. I still don't own my own cab. You know why? Because I don't want to. I must be what I want. You know, to be on the night shift, driving somebody else's cab. You understand? I mean, you become the job. I mean, like, one guy lives in Brooklyn, one guy lives in Sutton Place. You get a lawyer, another guy's a doctor. Another guy dies, another guy gets well, and, you know, people are born. I envy you, your youth. Go on, get laid. Get drunk, you know, do anything. Because you got no choice anyway. I mean, we're all fucked. More or less, you know? Yeah, I don't know. That's about the dumbest thing I ever heard. It's not Bertrand Russell, but what do you want? I'm a cabbie, you know? What do I know? I mean, I don't even know what the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I don't know either.
Don't worry so much. Relax, Killer. You're going to be all right. I know. I've seen a lot of people, and I know.
He was trying to get help. He's talking, but he's going to the wrong place. And this lets him down, in a sense. And it just carries on his mental illness or the journey that he's going to go to, which is the end of the film. So I just wanted to bring that up. Someone else brought up The Wizard earlier, or talked about that. Chrissy, you were the one that we were going to discuss it. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I thought it was interesting because, again, it's like when you go to work at your own day job, you know, and you've just got a lot to unload. And perhaps these individuals that you work with that are in the trenches with you in that day job, and maybe you even seriously respect them and think that they are on the same level as you. Sometimes they're not, and they'll just give you this wacky advice and you're just like, whatever. And the interesting thing to me about that scene was just like you said, it isolated him further. It made him feel like the one safe place he thought he could go to talk about something in the end proved that he couldn't. But also I had the same issue as Eric did with identifying him as, you know, someone serious because of putting on the Ritz, you know, which just made me die laughing as a kid. I just thought that was so funny. But that was difficult too.
Dupa, dupa!
Yeah, totally. Oh my God. Oh my God. I've never laughed so, I mean, he made me just laugh so hard. And it was one of,
and you feel for the reason why actors get typecast.
Yeah, I know. I know.
So,
however, yeah. I think that he did a marvelous job having that same sense of awkwardness. That's what was unique about his performance in particular, is that he had the same awkward that Travis did. It's just that what he was saying didn't go deep enough. And I thought that was really brilliantly done. And I've seen Peter Boyle in a lot of other serious stuff. And he's a brilliant actor. And I'm just sorry he doesn't get more recognition than he does. I mean, he gets a lot of recognition, but not enough in my opinion. But that's what I think was pivotal about
that
scene.
He's passed away now.
Here's a guy who is going to another coworker who's in the trenches with him for help. But the other guy is just as uncommunicative and disconnected as he is.
Chrissy, the only way this would have been worse, only way this would have been worse, because basically he's clueless and he doesn't know how to answer. But a lot of people that are in the trenches that work with you, and you go to them behind backs, they're going to laugh at you. And they could have even gone there if they really wanted to, like, oh my God, Travis, he's fucking nuts, or what a loser, you know, whatever. And so I learned that early when I was a young kid, to never tell anybody any of that shit, because you can't trust anybody because people suck, as Eric says. So,
all of Phil's secrets are just pouring out tonight.
Yes, seriously.
I go to my priest. I don't go to my coworkers. So even though there's a lot of good folks, but I still wouldn't trust them.
You still can't commit to statement in case it offends somebody.
That's true.
Yeah, well, here's the interesting thing today. I took just diverting for 5 seconds, but it is relevant to this, Phil. There was a girl who was laughing at me today because I signed up for the earthquake preparedness course and I actually took it.
And stabbed her.
No, and here's the deal. She's laughing at me and she says to me after the course is over, she's a dumbass anyway. This girl can't even fucking spell. She's such an idiot. All right. And
wait, hold on. Did you say she can't fucking spell or she can't spell?
Continue.
She can't fucking spell. She's a complete jackass. All right. So she says to me, even basic shit. Okay. So anyway, she says to me, she goes, she's literally laughing at me and she's saying, are you having fun with that course? Cause we don't get earthquakes in the Northeast, you know, I don't know why you're wasting your time. And I turned around and looked at her and I said, that's awesome. You must have been high when the earthquake aftershock from Virginia hit us in 2011. And I said, and guess what? I'm the emergency coordinator for this office. So when I know everything and you don't, I'm going to leave your sorry ass here and not tell you what to do, and you can figure it out.
Well,
would
even,
you rather
even,
do that?
Even worse, so though, Chrissy.
She the color drained from her face because I'm like, because I can just leave you here. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, but you know what, Chrissy?
I'm like, you asshole.
None of that even matters, Chrissy, because the point is there was no reason for her to laugh at you because you're just taking a class because you think it's fun or you think, who cares? You can do it
either way.
That's the point. You have an idiot, and I basically said, when there's an earthquake, I'll be sure to put you on the list to leave you the fuck behind.
And here's a helpful tip.
Shut right the fuck down after that because she knew I was serious.
Now, what's that, Mike?
I was going to say that's one way to handle it. I found that when somebody's laughing at me, a great way to go is, ha ha ha, step.
There you go.
And tonight is the night when Eric realizes that that his podcasting co-hosts are people too.
Yeah.
Now, all right. Let's wrap up this. See if we have time after for what we've been watching. But if not, we can wait until next week. But let's wrap up this film here. Any other scenes that we missed? There's a lot of good scenes, but any that are significant that you wanted to talk about? Anybody? Anyone?
I'm good.
All right. So let's wrap up and talk about our final thoughts of the film. Mike, why don't you start?
What a pretentious piece of shit. No, this is obviously, it's obviously.
Some would probably say that, Mike, to be honest.
I'm sure some would, but again, this is a film that I don't think is heavy-handed. It is an exercise in simple storytelling and letting the actors and the scenes play themselves out to tell a character. It's a character piece. It's a character study. And it's been something that's been often imitated. Probably never quite equaled and certainly never surpassed. It's not for me my favorite Scorsese film. And it's
heresy!
No, not heresy. It just isn't. But it's it is a film that at the very least anyone who can
that word means.
He's a commie rat. Anyway, continue.
I say anyone who's a cinephile, anyone who's interested in films and film history, this has to be on your list, your bucket list at some point. You need at least one watch. You don't have to obsessively watch over it like some people.
Phil?
Who are we talking about, actually? I don't know.
I haven't watched it for a good 7 or 8 years. I watched it like 50 times in the past, but then I haven't watched it for 7 years until this week.
I imagine you like the lead character in Human Centipede 2, just watching it over and over and over again. Filling up your little notebook.
Continue, nice. Mike. But anyway, continue.
No, that's pretty much what I have to say. I think this is something that it's a good film. It's an important, a great film. It's an important film. It's not on my personal favorite list, but it's just not in the type of film that I necessarily would gravitate to anyway. but that's not a knock against it in any way. It's again, it's an important film worth watching.
Heretic. Sorry. Yeah. All right. Very good. Abe.
This is a fantastic film. Very stylish, great performances all around. Very raw, great, lovely atmosphere. And yeah, this is definitely a film you should see. Whether it's your kind of preferred form or genre, or you just want to see some unique forms of cinematography. It's a film you at least see once, in my opinion. And I'm very glad I got the chance to finally see it after so long. So go check it out.
Right, very good. Yeah, for me, I experienced it when I was a young kid. So
10 years old.
10 years old. And so such a film would immediately make an impact just for that fact. And so I think it has been the number one film that out of all the films I've ever watched to form my tastes. In a sense, because I saw it at such an impressionable age at 10, yeah. And however, it is an absolutely fantastic film in so many different ways. I think it has a lot to say. I'll say that it's a film that rages against the machines, which makes it even better. Even though I may be reading more into it than you folks may, I would highly recommend it. It is my sixth favorite film of all time, no matter the genre. And it's for a reason there, because it's just a great film. And it is the reason that Paul Schrader is my favorite screenwriter of all time, because he's a god. God bless him. All
right. Only sixth, Phil?
Yeah, well, I got Lawrence of Arabia is number one, Citizen Kane number two, Midnight Cowboy number three, La Dolce Vita, number four, and the original Manchurian Candidate is number five. So this would be number six.
Yeah. Heretic!
Sorry. But, well, to be honest, number one is always there. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia is just the best film ever made in the history of the world. But two to eight could mix and match. They could move, shift, you know, a little bit.
Yeah,
I hear you.
Yeah. All right, Eric.
Taxi Driver is a very good movie.
Anything else, sir?
Nope. I think it's been covered.
Okay, very good. And Chrissy?
When you are done watching today's relentless parade of shit, as I was reminded, I sat down and watched Taxi Driver and went, oh my God, there is still such a thing as just joy in watching a really good film. A film that you can analyze and go 59 ways from Sunday with all the symbolism and all of that, or you can just sit and enjoy it for what it is, because it is that good. This film hits it on every level. And although it's still completely watchable as entertainment. You can take this either way. And when you come out at the end, you've still had a really awesome experience. And it's art that isn't pretentious. And for right now, we're getting a lot of this pretentious stuff. We're also getting a lot of stuff that is so shallow and not well thought out. And
31.
Honestly, yeah, like 31.
Uh-huh. Blair Witch.
Blair Witch. Blair Witch 2. Yep. And Gallows, you know, whatever.
Yeah, fuck the Gallows.
Hush.
Fuck the Gallows. Fuck the Gallows. But my point is that I was so surprised, because when I sat down and watched this last night, I had actually forgotten what it was like to just watch a really good film and not overthink it. And then I got scared, because I thought, my God, there is such a stream of shit out there. So if anybody is depressed about the stream of shit, go get Taxi Driver.
Yeah, but I do want to point out that you probably also had crap like Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo, you know, in 1976. You know, they had their fair share of shit, too, in the 1970s. Yeah, they weren't all Taxi Driver.
I think this group on this podcast just needed to watch a classic good movie, because we hit a particularly bad patch recently.
We really did. We threw a very bad streak. Like,
it's good to recompose ourselves and dive back into the glut of movies that will come out around Halloween.
And actually, this was going to be my film to recommend for 250. Knowing that it's up near Phil's top list, and since he started off, not too, yeah, 250, started it off, I figured we could do one of his favorites, and then you guys jumped on Psycho, and so said, okay, we'd save this for later, so I'm glad we didn't have to wait too long to do this.
I agree. It's a great film. The 40th anniversary was a perfect time to do it anyway, even if we didn't do it at episode 250, but what turns out is we were able to do two great films, Psycho and Taxi Driver, in a 3 or 4 week span after, I guess, as Eric stated, and I think you too, Mike, The Drain that Killer Fish Fest did after a while, even though it was still good films in a sense, there was it got tiring a little bit, I guess, is what you guys
said. Except for that fucking Phantom from 10,000 Leagues.
Curse you, Abe Spinney!
Thank you.
Well, you know what? Because it sucks so bad, that might have been the best episode.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I'm sure.
Yeah, that was a good episode. It was. But yeah, it's good that we did this film because even though we do, I would say, out of all the genre, even though we do fantasy, sci-fi, et cetera, horror seems to be the number one that we do, so it's always good to get a good thriller or exploitation or cult film in there every so often, and this one just happens to be a classic. So yeah, it's good to
be. Well, and this film is horror in its own way. It's very horror in a very poetic sense, and we don't do a lot of that. I mean, this is the horror of the human mind. This is the horror of someone melting down. And films like that have to be very well crafted, like Sunchoke. I mean, you compare a film like Sunchoke, which we did last week.
Great film.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, to something whatever. Like this, not really. When you see Taxi Driver and you see that Sunchoke is in the same genre as this, Sunchoke is just not as well done. But it's not, it didn't leave you feeling like, wow. Even I didn't make
it for me,
notes on this film.
It did for me.
Right.
Well, are you saying that Sunchoke is as good as Taxi Driver?
Yeah.
No, but Sunchoke will be one of the best horror films of this year, in my opinion.
No, but whatever. But my point is just that there are other avenues of things that are horrifying or dark that we can cover that aren't necessarily just branded as horror or sci-fi or this or that. You know, sometimes that walks a fine line. And I think Taxi Driver hits all those points that like a good post story does. It's a man unraveling and it's done well.
Yeah, and Dark Discussions has done some episodes that aren't strictly horror. For example, The Gray was an excellent example of a film that would fall into that other genre category, as well as me and Eric early on did Rear Window and a few other films. So Taxi Driver fits that perfectly, especially since it is the grindhouse exploitation feel of the 70s that it has wrapped in a thriller and as a character study, and as even you said, Chrissy, some ways horror. So it fits in perfectly. And anybody who hasn't seen it should definitely see it, because it's one of those, not only a bucket film, a bucket list film, but anybody who likes horror and genre, it's a film you should see just for that fact alone. And it's great. It's the best. And try to get it into a time machine and watch it when you're 10 years old, because that makes it even better.
I can't even comment about that.
I just want to know which of us is going to be the one that called Child Protective Services tonight. That's what I want to.
Anyway,
I will say, Phil, I'm so glad you didn't name either of your children Iris.
Yeah, that would be a little weird. Yeah.
I was gonna be a little weird. He wasn't even like denying it.
Iris okay. Iris and Betsy. That's what I should have. No, honestly, Chrissy, I wanted all French first names of my daughters.
Yeah, I know.
Well, that's a different form of abuse.
Yeah. indeed. depending on your perspective.
Huh? That's the new. Saw you coming, you fucking shitheel. I'm standing here. You make a move. It's your move. shy of you. You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Then who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. Who the fuck do you think you're talking to? Oh, yeah? Huh? Okay.
Huh? So that was Taxi Driver. So 1976, written by Academy Award winner Paul Schrader, directed by Academy Award winner Martin Scorsese, starring Academy Award winner Robert De Niro, and starring Academy Award winner Jodie Foster, and starring Academy nominee Harvey Keitel, and starring Academy Award nominee, I believe, from
Albert.
Sybil Shepherd for the one that she did with Jeff Bridges right around that time, the black and white film. Oh, I forget what it's called.
Okay. And Albert Brooks, also Academy Award nominee.
Is that true? There you go.
Absolutely.
Bernard Herrmann, a lot of that role,
Academy
too.
Award winner, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and Bernard Herrmann, that score is amazing. Like I said, we take that up to our cocktail parties at the cemetery.
And
that is
think about this. The what was this? What was the film? Do you know this one? The first film Bernard Herrmann scored.
Oh, this is going to kill me. I, to be honest, I probably don't know because it was way back in the 30s.
Can I give you a hint?
Sure.
Number two.
Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane. You start your career with Citizen Kane,
yep.
And you end your career with Taxi Driver.
That's awesome.
That's an incredible fucking career.
And Mike, I should have known that because he worked with Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater, and we discussed that in our World War of the Worlds episode.
Okay.
Where I talked about how the radio version of the War of the Worlds, the music played by the band that was playing, I forget the name of the band, I used to know it, was actually Bernard Herrmann on the War of the Worlds live radio cast by Orson Welles. The band was Herrmann, Bernard Herrmann doing the whole band. So there you go. 76 degrees to Bernard Herrmann. That's right. The movie that I was talking about for Sybil Shepherd was The Last Picture Show.
That was it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and you look at the careers. I mean, obviously you had Sybil Shepherd, you know, went on to be have a big career. Jodie Foster had a huge career. Albert Brooks had a huge career. I mean, it didn't all turn out great because Robert De Niro ended up in Meet the Fockers, but otherwise, I think everybody else turned out pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. Harvey Keitel. I mean, they're all
Harvey Keitel, so. Pulp Fiction, and was he in Sexy Beast?
No, he was in Reservoir Dogs. Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. Ben Kingsley was a sexy beast. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And if you want to see a film that Harvey Keitel is awesome in, the Bad Lieutenant. I think that's
Bad Lieutenant. That's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was awesome in that. Yeah, that was a character study that was very disturbing. The whole scene when he like freaks out and kicks in the radio because he lost the bet. Oh my god, it was awesome. Anyway, that's Taxi Driver. Great film. One of the best. Awesome stuff. Now, with that stated, did we want to talk? Oh, the email I found out is actually a Westworld email, so it's not Dark Discussion. So we'll read that.
Okay.
For Westworld.
Woohoo!
But anybody want to talk about any films they've seen?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Eric.
This week there was a very limited release of Shin Godzilla in the U.S., and it was showing at a theater near me for precisely three nights. Tonight being the last night. So I got out to see it last night and saw Shin Godzilla in a theater with my buddy Dan and his wife. I think this is the first Japanese Godzilla movie I've seen in the theater, so that was kind of fun. The actual Godzilla in the movie is awesome. But not nearly enough of them. About 20 minutes of awesome Godzilla fighting, and the movie has a 2-hour runtime. So I didn't think that ratio was the best.
So in other words, like almost every other Godzilla movie.
Well, no, I think there's even less Godzilla than most Godzilla movies. There's also an interesting aspect into it. I don't want to get in too much into it, but the Godzilla isn't Godzilla for part of the movie, which doesn't make sense when I say it, but if you watch the movie, it will.
He doesn't have gender dysphoria, does he?
Well, no, he...
Don't spoil it.
No, I'll see it.
Yeah, I'm trying not to, but Mike's kind of forcing my hand.
Yeah, don't. Just ignore him.
The word no would have been suffice. It would have sufficed. That would have been,
that's so all. Continue.
There's a lot of political commentary and commentary about bureaucracy on it. Some of it is pretty funny. Like at the beginning of the movie, they're trying to figure out what's going on when Godzilla first shows up. And they're like, is it a volcano event that opened up under the sea? And they're like, oh, well, that would fall under the Bureau of Geography and Land Formations. Oh, well, then we need to be in their office. So you see a shot of all these Japanese suits marching down the hall to go to that office. And they're like, no, wait, it's a marine life form. That falls under the Bureau of Biology and blah, 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 blah. So you see them marching down the hallway to go to that. And they can't have the discussion unless they're in the right office to have the discussion. So that was kind of amusing. And there are moments like that that are kind of funny, but a lot of it just like, ah, oh, come on. When's shit going to blow up? Overall, it was a kind of a miss for me. I didn't think there was quite enough in there to keep me entertained for the full 2-hour runtime. But at the same time, I was pretty glad that I got out to the theater to see it.
And it uses the classic music to it, right?
It's not reinvented. It does. It has the same theme from the original Gojira. That
very good.
So, yeah.
Anything else, Eric?
Yeah. Dave Z over at the Exploding Heads podcast on the Horrorphilia Network posted about a movie on Netflix called The Secrets of Emily Blair.
Awesome film.
And Phil was like, oh, I'm so glad you posted about this and I'll watch it, and thanks for giving me a heads up. I told you about this movie last week, Phil.
I apologize.
I remembered, and I usually don't pay attention, let alone have to go back and re-edit everything.
So I just wanted to throw out that. But talking about Dave Z, the Exploring Heads podcast is a little different than what we do here. I like it. You should check it out if you like horror podcast collections and you want to add another one. Go add that one.
Yep, I would agree with that. Anything else, Eric?
That's it for me.
All right. Yeah, I just have two as well. The first one was The Secret of Emily Blair, which Eric just brought up. Yes, Eric recommended it, and I forgot about it until Dave Z mentioned it. And then when I re-edited last week's episode today during my lunch hour, I said, oh, yeah, there it is. Eric did mention it. But either way, it's free on Netflix. Eric said he liked it a pretty – good film, and Dave Z gave it 7.5 out of 10 stars, and I would say that it's a great film. I think I like it a lot more than Eric, even though Eric said he liked it. I would put it as a top 20 horror film of the year. Chrissy, you would love this film, I think.
I'm thinking about checking it out. I'm gonna put it on my watch list for
It's free on Netflix if you're a subscriber to Netflix, so it's definitely worth checking out. I had just watched another film, Under the Shadows, a Persian language film from Britain, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, I think, and that was a massively disappointing film. I thought it was a ripoff of Dark Water, the Japanese horror film. So I would recommend not checking that out unless you can get it for free. So after watching that crap fest, Dave Z posted about The Secret of Emily Blair, and I said, oh, I'm going to watch that right after, and thank God I watched it because it made my night compared to watching that crap fest that I saw first. So, high recommend. I love the film, And it's the type of film that if it came out with commentaries and all that, I would buy the disc. And another film I wanted to mention, and it's not Under the Shadows. That was just a horrible film. The film is Lights Out. Just hit VOD. I was at the theaters a bit ago. I think Mike or Abe saw it at the theaters. I forget which.
I think it was Christy, actually, wasn't it?
It was Mike.
Oh, it was Mike. Okay. And I would state that I think this film at the moment will be the best horror film of the year, in my opinion. Lights Out was fantastic. Scary as hell. That's what I want in a horror film, is to be scared, and that scared the hell out of me. It even passes all the art house films that I like Sunchoke and Nina Forever. And it even passes The Corpse of Anna Fritz, Eric. Yes, it does.
Well, I've heard nothing but good things about Lights Out from...
It's a good movie.
Not the general populace, but like the people that just really enjoy a good horror scare, and I've heard nothing but good things, and I've already got the DVD on my order list. So.
It's awesome.
Mike disagrees.
Yes, Mike, go ahead.
No, it's. I think 10-year-old Phil had a better taste in films, but it's... I thought it. I think that it has good scares. I think the character of what's her name, Diana.
The lead actress. Yeah, the lead character. Yeah. The dark character. Yeah.
The ghosty character.
Yeah.
I think is a good creation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the story is I think really.
It was like Martyrs, but supernatural.
No, I thought the story was just not all that.
I thought it was pretty bare bones for the most part.
Yeah, it was very, it was like Cliff Notes version of a, you know, it's a ghost story, so we're just gonna hit the points, you know what they are, don't pay too much attention. Oh, scary part! So it had the potential, but it needed a whole lot more development, in my opinion.
And that's just your opinion.
Yeah, but, anyway.
It's a number one film of the year.
Okay. Well, it's kind of like what I thought about The Darkness. I was really shut, you know, and Mike and I had a discussion about that in a previous episode, so we won't rehash that. But Mike had a different experience with it than I did, in that I thought I could suspend my disbelief on the stuff that was kind of dumb and just enjoy it as a well put together story. Aside from the fact they had a few stupid things in there and there was some things that dropped, I could still buy it. Now, and that makes a difference.
What's that?
I was just going to say, I'm going to have to check this out. I have a feeling I'm going to be closer to Mike than I am to Phil on this one, because there was it was based on a short. Yeah. And I saw the short, and the short was pretty awesome, and I just don't know how you could extend that into a feature-length film and keep it effective.
That's the movie for next week, I'm telling you. Sorry.
I don't think either one is awful. I just think they're kind of – they felt like sort of mail-the-check-in films. They're just very mediocre, terribly memorable.
I would have to disagree. The critics are on our side, Chrissy. The critics are on our side. It got – oh, close to 80% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, really? I don't know.
It did.
But I don't usually pay attention to the critics anyway. I have to make my own decision.
I agree.
I pretty much see a lot of bad shit
let me rephrase, Chrissy. The critics usually hate horror films.
That's true.
And yet they like this one.
Which means that they're not their taste shouldn't be aligning with the horror audience.
No, well, it means it passes over the horror to the general population. Uh-huh.
Well, I have an extra day off this weekend, so I'll check it out.
Yeah, Phil. So listen, in 20 years, when Scream Factory comes out with the special edition ultraviolet disc version of this, and you can tell me you told me so.
Oh, no, this film's awesome, dude. This scared the fuck out of me. Dude, this has so many awesome set pieces.
Yeah, that's why I didn't. That's actually why I haven't seen it, because honestly, I told Phil this online. The commercials for it scared the living shit out of me, and I'm like, okay, I'm sure the story's gonna be weak or whatever, but
it's the imagery was awesome.
That gets me. And if the imagery is that terrifying, maybe I need to watch this in the morning with coffee and then go to work.
Oh yeah, I even told you that.
So that it washes my brain out.
You have to watch it at 8 a.m. Yeah, you have to.
Because I'll get too scared and I won't sleep.
The ending's awesome. The how the ghost is always there as long as it's dark. I mean, oh my God, it's awesome. It's the best. Sorry, Mike.
I think Phil liked it.
Yeah, I did. It was really, really good. Hey, Abe, you said you liked it, right?
I thought it was pretty good for the most part. I mean, it wasn't the best film ever, but I overall liked it. I saw not too long ago, actually. I think I was the one who brought it up at one point. So.
Yes, you did. You did, yeah.
Phil, I'm thinking that you are, in fact, part dog.
What do you mean?
Because if you look, you have a dog. I've had dogs. Dogs are either barking their head off at something,
yep,
or they're like, that makes them as the happiest thing in the world. There is, you've never met a dog that went, "How you doing?" Okay. They're either great or they're really mad.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Right.
And you go,
they cut the asparagus.
I'll go with that, Mike. I'll go with that.
Oh my goodness.
That's fair.
Just swinging. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, but the thing is with this film here, Mike, even though you thought it was just okay or maybe mediocre, when I saw it, it hit every cue I want in a horror film. And literally it's like, oh, this is a film I got to watch over and over. This film will be in my rotation for months. Months. It'll be a Halloween film every year.
Take some lithium.
Yeah. So
okay.
Anyway.
All right.
I recommend.
Hopefully it doesn't get entered into as part of the divorce proceedings.
And it stars the same chick from Warm Bodies, and that was a damn good film too.
That was a good movie, actually.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Warm Bodies. I thought that was really awesome.
Awesome film. Yep. And this actress is great. Yes, fantastic. And plus she's hot too. But she's great. It's great. Great. The whole everything's great about it. Anyway, that's what I had to say. Mike, you have seen anything of interest?
Like Eric, I'd watched the Luke Cage series on Netflix, and I got to say, I'm with Eric. I'm disappointed in the way it ended, because they shift villains about 9 episodes in or 8 episodes in, and they did not develop the introduction of the villain well at all, and especially since the villain comes with this whole baggage tied into the main character that was not set up at all. Right, so he's just suddenly, here he is, and very quickly, 5 minutes, bum, 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 bunch of expo dump, and, oh, this is how this character is connected, the villain is tied to the lead, and this is why it's emotionally resonant, why it's important, and why we're going to watch this pissing match for the next 5 or 6 episodes, however many were left. I actually think the final episodes were stronger from a technical point of view. I think they got more confident as the series went along. They used the directed better. It was shot better. It was they used the music better. But the lead villain was just so much worse than the villain they started out with.
I agree.
And the other thing, I watched something by accident on Netflix.
What?
Well, I was going to try to find something to watch, and I accidentally hit the button on play on a movie that I was just playing on scrolling through, and I was so what the fuck at that point. I just said, whatever, I'll let it go, see if it's any good. And it's this movie called ARQ.
Oh, I saw that.
Did you see it or saw it?
I didn't watch it, but I saw it.
Right, okay. So it's, I'm gonna spoil it a little bit right now, in that this sort of fits in the Groundhog's Day, Edge of Tomorrow, or Live, Die, Repeat, or, Blood Punch was another one in that category of the time loop sort of story. So you should know that going in. It's a decent little low budget science fiction film. It loses points because it's no longer an original thing. And in fact, it's been done well at least a couple of times. So it's actually ends up feeling derivative for that reason. But I think they did a decent job with it. And it's not bad if you're looking for something in the science fiction vein.
Anything else? Nice of it.
No, that was all that I can remember.
Okay. What about you, Abe? Anything?
No, not on my end.
All right. What about you, Chrissy? Anything?
Yeah, I finally got to watch The Pact.
It was pretty good film, yeah.
It was good. But then
wasn't that motorcycle scene awesome or what?
The chick, hot chick in the panties, whatever, Phil. I was like, yeah, I don't swing that way, so that's fine.
It was still an awesome scene, though.
It was still a great scene. But what was better, even better for me, was after I watched this film, I listened to the commentary. And to hear the director, the commentary is wonderful because he talks about all the homages he made in this film to, like, Bad Ronald. And he talked about the motorcycle scene where she gets on it with the panties. And he spends a lot of time talking about how that was actually an homage to 70s grindhouse films. And just a great film. I highly recommend it. It is a ghost story, but it also has a twist to it. But they work together. They really work in tandem. I think this is a brilliant film. I'm sad that he keeps mentioning the short, but I guess because of distribution reasons, he couldn't put the original short on the DVD. So you don't get to see the original short. Which kind of made me sad. I also watched Lake Nowhere, which was just 50 minutes of screaming fun. Very 70s, loads of fun, just has the look of something you'd see in the 1970s. It was like Squirm or something like that.
Christy, where did you get to see that? Because it's only on VOD, right? Or is it by the disc? Did you? Because I know the disc just came out.
No, it's only on VOD and you can get it on Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, no, you can order the DVD, but it's a lot more expensive. And I'm not sure if it's DVD or Blu-ray. I think it's only Blu-ray. I'm not sure. However, there are a lot of special features on it. I'm going to actually order it so I can own it because I want to watch the special features, but I wanted to see the movie first because it's very short. It's only 45 or 50 minutes long or something. So I wanted to just kind of check it out before I went and spent all that money, to own it. So yeah, that's pretty much what I watched this week. And, I had a good week in terms of that. Also, I was lucky enough that Patrick Ray, I reached out to him because there was a short that he's going to get distributed soon called The Hourglass Figure, which I think I mentioned earlier, but he sent me private links to some of his other shorts. And I'm extremely excited. I've spent my whole week watching that. So shout out to Patrick. Your shit is awesome. And I hope this stuff gets on a DVD because I'm a really, I'm really big on shorts.
Chrissy, are you good? You should check out, it's on disc, you can buy it, Nailbiter, or you can view
it. Oh, okay, yeah, I haven't seen that yet, it's been on my pile,
That's his feature, film debut, as a matter of fact, full-length feature debut. He directed
that.
That's
pretty good.
Yeah, it was a bottle film, people stuck in a basement, it's pretty good.
Well, yeah. So, Chris, he spent the weekend watching a man's shorts, got it.
Yeah.
Anything else, Chrissy?
Nope.
All right, that's good. So that's our episode for tonight. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in tonight to listen to us talk about Taxi Driver. Come back next week. We'll be talking about something else.
And cue Bernard Herrmann or Chris Christopherson or someone. I don't know which.